Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of the Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
I would have to say it's his anger. I mean, he goes from 0 to 100 in a second flat.
Come on.
Do you feel this is an accurate assessment?
I'm a very calm guy. I mean, whether it's that's... I'm a very calm person, all right? Whether I'm at work or in a social situation, I am extremely calm. But my wife, who I love very dearly, she likes to nag, and I react to the nagging.
Overreact.
Sometimes, okay, maybe, but without the nagging, no reaction.
Well, what he calls nagging, I call trying to have a relationship.
Look, there's no proverbial judge sitting on a bench judging you.
Ari, I told you to turn that off.
I did turn it off, but this is the emergency line. This is the bat line, baby.
Do you need to get that?
I do need to take this,
no,
yes.
No, he doesn't. I asked for 1 hour out of a day for his undivided attention, and I can't even have that.
You can have it if you want to live in a girl's hills and go to group therapy, but if you want a Beverly Hills mansion and you want a country club membership and you want 9 weeks a year and a Tuscan villa, then I'm going to need to take a call when it comes in at noon on a motherfucking Wednesday.
Covered up my clock. Damn. There we go. It is 28 minutes after the hour of one, and this the month of February in the year of our Lord 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district here in glorious Portland, Oregon, where all good things derive. Specifically, the southeast portion, which I believe is being pelted by some sort of a combination of rain and slush and sleet and snow and hail and possibly oobleck. Did you hear that? Just you had your headphones on.
Yeah, I did.
As we were prepping, it was like someone was just throwing handfuls of viscous glop against the window out here.
That doesn't sound good at all.
And then it was like it was gone, and the sun appeared, and then the sun vanished, and then the weather, the weather we currently have just sort of came back. So there's some sort of we've angered a deity of some kind, Don. Clearly the...
I know why. It's angry. They're punishing KGW.
Yes,
the weather gods are punishing KGW for wanting to call it Snowlandia
with a bird on it. Yeah, it's humor. Somebody actually said during Legion of News last hour, I revealed that, and this is, again, I have to give credit to Cheryl Kanakoa because she's the one who pointed this out to me. We were in Beaverton for Outlook Portland, and I said, you know, we walked outside, it was cold, and, you know, I'm not trying to be a guy who's always talking about the weather and the elements and the climate and the used to be hot and now it's chilly kind of a guy. But I said, well, you know, God damn, it's cold out here. And she just, like, stopped in her tracks. She goes, oh, my God, did you watch KDW this morning? And I said, no. And she said, oh, my God, they said the stupidest thing. And I said, what? And she said, they're suggesting that we call the storm Snowlandia ellipsis with a bird on it. And I actually made her repeat it two or three times because I thought that she was... I thought that she'd gotten it wrong or that I was mishearing it or that she was maybe combining a couple of different things that they had said. Because it didn't seem possible that somebody would actually utter that phrase and all. And not just utter the phrase, utter it like as an imperative, as a direction to you, the viewer. And so we revealed this during Legion of News. I repeated KGW's whole Snowlandia with a bird on it thing. And then immediately, like, three different things went wrong on the show. And it's like you were trying to say something and you kept mispronouncing it. And I was transposing some words. And somebody said that we'd opened a sort of necronomicon of retardation. Just by uttering it aloud, it's like I'd said the Klaatu Varado necktie thing or something.
Because it is possibly the single stupidest thing I've heard in a very long time. And this is and
we, that's saying something.
And we truck in people saying stupid things.
We it is
daily.
It is the common currency of the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We traffic in stupidity. I mean, look, we peddle it ourselves, but we also pass along, we convey. We are the intermediaries, the middlemen for the stupidity of others. So often guys who spend their time drinking a lot and then juggling bricks with their cousins. So I'm just saying, we're grading on a curve, but not the way you normally do. I mean, we're grading on sort of an inverse curve here. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. 503-505-6964 if you'd like to be part of today's program, if you'd like to weigh in, if you'd like to make your observations, if you'd like to chat, put your feet up, shoot the breeze, pass the time. Missing something else? Chew the fat? I think people do.
Yeah, that's the thing they do.
Chew the fat if you'd like to do that as well.
They jaw.
If you'd like to just sort of, have a little give and take, if you'd like to spend a little time pontificating, kibitzing, ruminating upon the eternal verities of life with your comments, questions, musings of an ironic nature, clarifications, obfuscations, recipes, whatever it is that might be taking up space in your brain, whatever it is that's in your head that you think ought to be outside your brain and now in the consciousness of everybody else. You can share that with us at 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Let's see. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. That is rick@rickemerson.com. Dawn Taylor can be emailed as well if that's your thing. It's Dawn, D-A-W-N, @rickemerson.com. That is Dawn@rickemerson.com. Text box on the website open. And then you can also message us via Skype if you like. That is Rick Emerson Show. That is the username there. All one word. Rick Emerson Show. Via Skype. Coming up today, we got your Taser watch. Coming up today. Is that it? Is that our only watch?
I also have a clown watch.
Okay, I was going to say.
I just espied a clown watch.
I didn't know whether to be, disappointed or unhappy. It was going to be surprising because it seems like there's been a sort of flood of watches, specifically clown watch, corpse watch.
Yeah.
Seems like we've had a lot of those, like a lot of dead folk turning up, and then the snuff watch. I mean, it's like the first day in what seems like weeks or just hadn't, somebody hasn't cacked it during the night. So, I mean, the show's not over yet, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a long road with no turning back. Anything could happen.
But we don't have anything that's cult related, do we?
What do you mean? Like a Manson watch?
Yeah, or like a Jonestown watch or anything like that.
What do you mean like a Jonestown watch? Nothing is like a Jonestown. Is this about Jonestown?
Yes.
Okay.
Kind of, yeah. It references Jonestown. So I didn't know if you had some kind of a Jim Jones watch. I don't know.
It doesn't seem like a lot's happening with Jim Jones since he died.
No.
Is it about the property?
No, it's about a ill-advised advertising campaign that referenced Jonestown.
I saw that. I didn't get a chance to read it. I just saw the headline because somebody sent it our way yesterday. Well, we'll just do that as a regular, it's one of our many amusing stories and anecdotes we share with the people. So we got Taser Watch coming up today. Clown Watch. I'll also get to another installment of the greatest songs ever made that's going to be coming up sometime in the next 25 minutes or so. Next hour, a little bit after 2 p.m. Pacific time for you cats listening live. Mr. Bill Carter will be in the studio. He's the author of Fools Rush In. He did the film Miss Sarajevo. And he's the author of the new book Red Summer, which is fantastic, by the way. And I strongly recommended a few years ago reading the book In the Heart of the Sea by Nathaniel Philbrick. And that's the story, they call it, it's the In the Heart of the Sea, the tragedy of the whale ship Essex. In the Heart of the Sea is the true story on which Herman Melville based Moby Dick. Just the story of a whaling ship that angered and was then attacked by and ultimately sunk by a huge sperm whale, and then the story of the survivors who...
It was the Jaws of its time.
It is really... You have no idea. Have you read In the Heart of the Sea? Have we talked about this?
No.
Jesus, God Almighty. I mean, it's a fantastic book. I mean, it really is. It is an unbelievable book, but it is... It is not unlike The Road in... And this is not the book that Bill Carter wrote, In the Heart of the Sea is not unlike The Road in that every night when I would, get ready to read for about half an hour before falling asleep, I would just sit down in bed next to my wife and I would reach over to the nightstand and I would pick up In the Heart of the Sea, which was given to me by this guy. It was given to me by the guy who was the general manager of CBS at the time, who really didn't warn me about the contents of it. He didn't do what I am doing for you now and just give me sort of a heads up. He just said, here's a book, because he saw me reading Into Thin Air, the John Krakauer book. He's like, well, if you like that, you might want to read this. And I said, okay, I'll put it on. And it's not like Into Thin Air is a big pick-me-up either. I mean, that's another thing where it just ends.
Yeah.
One of those books where there's an 80% attrition rate by the end. So he hands me In the Heart of the Sea, and I got about two chapters in. And it was like where every night I would sit down, and I would get into bed, and I would reach over to the nightstand, and I would pick up In the Heart of the Sea. And I would look at it, and I would just kind of go, Because it was like pulling a black shroud over myself for about 45 minutes every night as I read it. It really is a fantastic book. Red Summer is not quite so grim, but it strays into some of that same territory. And of course, In the Heart of the Sea takes place, you know, a century and change ago. Red Summer is about the 4 summers that Bill Carter spent as a commercial fisherman in Alaska. You know, it was the whole sort of Deadliest Catch thing. But he did that for 4 years, and it's not just a depiction of the industry itself, but also that town and the villages that are there. And the culture in those places, because Deadliest Catch, more which I love, but that's just, you know, that's the sort of action on the boat, and everybody sort of, and I'm not trying to downplay that, because like a thing where you got a 60 times normal rate of death among your employees, I mean, that's a job that is, I mean, there's some excitement to be had there. I mean, you take your average American job and you are 60 times more likely to die as a commercial fisherman. What a lot of people, I think, don't know is that Alaska itself is no prize. I mean, that's to say, it leads the entire country in suicide and alcoholism, and also sex crimes. So, but you get these people, they just live and work every day in these fishing villages that are effectively just these sort of lawless outposts. I mean, there's these enclaves where there is quite literally no law, because the authorities and the police are just hours away. And so it becomes, I read actually something a few years ago, and then we'll actually get back on track here, but we were talking about some of this on Outlook Portland. I read a few years ago something that should not have surprised me, but it did, which is that James Cameron actually used, he had either spent time or traveled through or had stayed in an Alaskan fishing village at one point, or he knew somebody who had, and he actually used the people and culture of those Alaskan fishing towns as the basis for the crew in Aliens. That sort of gritty truckers in space kind of a thing.
I can see that.
It really is. Anyway, but Red Summer, it really is a fantastic book, and so we'll talk about that.
When I was in culinary school, one of the opportunities available at the end of graduating from culinary school was to go and do a few months at a fishing camp in Alaska. And I was lucky enough to talk to a guy that I was in school with who had done that. He had done like 6 months or something. And he was not, you know, against it. But he did explain that for the ridiculous amount of money that one was being paid to live and cook at a fish camp for like 4 months, what was actually involved in your stay there. And much like people I knew who worked as cooks on cruise lines, once you hear what it's actually like living under those conditions, you realize why they pay so much money for people to do it and why they have to, like, you know, rotate the crew through like every 4 to 6 months.
Well, he we'll get more into this later, but he talked about having the initial phone call from this woman named Sharon Hart, who was she was, I believe, then the only, and she still is, but she was then at that point the only female crew chief that there was. She was the only female, you know, sort of skipper, because it was just such a harsh, unforgiving, terrible place that I think most women went there and they went, well, F this is ridiculous. And of course, guys, you know, not always thinking things all the way through, they just said, well, stick it out. But being on the phone and he was in Phoenix or wherever at the time, and being on the phone with this woman, Sharon Hart, and she said, okay, now you're going to need to go to like your Walmart or your Kmart or whatever and buy the following like 70 things, you know, and here's what you'll need in terms of clothing and shoes and first aid. And she's like running him through the list of stuff he would have to bring with him. And she kept going back to like, and make sure there's no buttons on it. Everything that she mentioned, she was like, you know, his pants and his shirt and his shoes. She's like, make sure the shoes don't have any, like that the laces don't have any like tassels or any, you know, there's nothing coming off the side to the shoes, that there's no metal tabs on the laces. And then she would go back to the, and make sure no buttons. Everything's got a zip, no buttons. And he finally said, well, why? And she said, well, because the net will catch it and you'll go overboard and drown. And then she would went on again, and apparently that was the thing that killed several people every year, is that a guy would just disregard the no buttons rule. They would have this net, and the net would go over. And you think a net, you think that thing from Gilligan's Island, like the skipper, you know, is sleeping in. And it's like a huge steel mesh net that immediately would ensnare itself in your buttons, and you're going over the side into 40-degree water, you know, like in the middle of the night. And there's no coming back from that. So I don't mean to make the book sound like a big buzzkill, but it is a very, it is gripping in the very best sense of the word. So he's here to talk about that, and then there's all that controversy going on with the pebble mine that they want to build up there. So Bill Carter will be in the studio with us next hour. By the way, just so this doesn't just lurk out in the room like a big lurking thing.
Oh.
So I got this guy, Mike, who works with a publisher and was, when Bill, because he lives in, Bill lives in Arizona. When he comes to town, there's this guy, Mike, who's his sort of liaison and who, you know, takes him around and sort of, you know, introduces him to media folks if he hasn't done anything before. And I know Mike because Mike used to be in this band called the Young Immortals. They came on our show a few times or whatever. So I've known him for a while and we've known, you know, Bill Carter for a while. So we're there in the green room at Outlook Portland this morning. And so it's me and Cheryl and Bill Carter and Mike. Mike says, "So, Rick, isn't it true that Bill Carter was the impetus for your wife's Authors I'd Like to F book club?" And then it just sat there in the room. That statement just sat there on the floor, just sort of looking at all of us for a long 7 or 8 seconds. Because Bill apparently hadn't been told that. That was his introduction to the entire concept. Nobody really... Mike just chose that moment to reveal not only the existence of the Authors I'd Like to F Club, but also that my wife had formed it, and also that Bill was the reason for that.
There we go.
That some other guys eventually got into the club, but really, it didn't exist for that reason. I think it was just... it's just sort of like, it was like a Gatsby thing, just throwing a party for that one special girl.
So you're not planning to have him over for dinner anytime
you
soon,
know,
is what you're saying.
Here's the thing is that unfortunately Lara's out of town today, and I just don't know how that happened. I have no, I'm sure it was just something that I overlooked on the calendar when she asked what was happening this week, and I said, I don't know. And she
said, nothing special.
Anything interesting in the program? Not really. Who's going to be there? Same old people. Any reason I should stay in town? None at all. So Bill Carter's going to be in the studio just scant feet away from me today. Bill Carter and his seductive blue eyes. By the way, you know where Lara is? Tacoma.
So there you go.
Tacoma, which is like the Alaskan fishing village of Washington.
It is the most romantic city in the country.
So I'm told. Or would be if she wasn't going up with a girlfriend to get her brother out of prison. You're listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. Don Taylor is... do we do headlines already?
No.
Okay, Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Wednesday.
Well, we do have the story of that Indiana eatery, which pulled their billboards referencing Jonestown. And a local thief who was busted just stealing snacks. And we'll find out why the king doesn't pay for cigarettes.
Okay, then. So that is all coming up. Taser Watch. We'll also have your EH Vending clue for Wednesday for the Name That Snack Contest for this week. The EH Vending Name That Snack Contest. We get your Wednesday clue. That is coming up later on. Find out more about EH Vending by going to ehvending.com. Mr. Bill Carter going to be in the studio with us, and we will at some point probably get to another installment of Greatest Songs Ever Made. Not now. We'll do this maybe next hour. I want to talk to you about Breaking Bad. And the only reason I do this is because it's already... I keep forgetting that it's February, and February's only like, you know, 28 days or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's only 2 or 3 days difference, but it does seem like things go by in the blink of an eye in this month. So I want to get Breaking Bad Season 1 discussed. Have you started Season 2?
I have.
Okay.
I believe I'm in the third episode of season 2.
I think it's
two.
After season 1, which is only 6 episodes because of the writer's strike,
right.
I believe that the other seasons are like 13 episodes or something. And I got to tell you, I'm not trying to, to make it anticlimactic or whatever the word is. But I would say this, that season 3 is great. Season 2, though, really is just, it's awesome. Season 2 of Breaking Bad is exemplary. It is, I think I mentioned this last week, I would put it up against anything that has ever aired. It is so great because what they did with Season 2 of Breaking Bad, and it's the last thing I'll say about it, before we put a pin in the conversation to later. Season 2 of Breaking Bad is great, not just for one reason, but there is one, I think, primary reason, there's one main reason, one something that informs everything else, which is before they sat down to shoot or film or rehearse a frame of season 2. I think that Vince Gilligan guy, who was the show runner and who was the head writer on that program, I think he just visualized the entire thing front to back. In other words, he had the complete picture in his head. It wasn't a thing where he was writing one episode and then he would send it off to everybody and then he'd write the next episode and send it off. I think he sat and he charted out the entire season on a wall or in a notebook or in a whiteboard or just in his head, and he thought through every single permutation of everything, and then he made sure that it all tied together as a piece. It links together. The second season of Breaking Bad ties together so perfectly and flawlessly that when it's done, you are just, at least I, when the final episode of season 2 happened, you're just sort of... It just has the most beautiful feeling of just completion. Not that the series needs to end, but it's like, you know what it is? It's like when you just see like a magician pull off the final little flourish of the trick. You know, and then suddenly, like, the assistant falls out of the rafters of the Delta Center. You go, my God, he's still alive. And he's covered in rose petals. And you realize that something has been done in front of you. Just this work of art has been constructed while you watched. And yet, there were elements of it that you didn't even see being built. I mean, it was being constructed in front of you. And parts of it you didn't even notice until the very end. So it is quite something.
I did want to address something television related while I have a chance. I've had three separate people email me now to ask me if I've seen the Showtime show episodes.
God damn. Is it the same people that are emailing me about it, or is it a different group of people?
Hey, well, I got like yet another email about it today.
Damn.
So I say that, yes, I've watched one episode of it. I watched the first episode, and I was quite pleased with it, actually, because it stars a couple of actors that I really, really like. I got particularly an actress named Tamsin Gregg, who was in two British series that I really loved, one called Black Books and another called Green Wing. And it's a Showtime, I think it's pretty short for Showtime, but it's about these two successful, married successful showrunners for a British television comedy who are offered a deal to adapt to their show in the U.S.
With Matt LeBlanc.
Yeah, and they come, and then the first episode, they come to L.A., they get installed in this giant house, which it turns out they get to live in for a few months because it was used for a reality show, and they still, like, the studio still has the lease on it. And then they find out that the producer who brought them over has never seen their show and knows nothing about it. And they have to audition the lead actor, who's played by Richard Griffiths, just really esteemed British actor who's awesome. And they force him to actually audition for the role he's already been playing for 4 years on British television and won many awards for. And, of course, they just decide he's too old and he's too English.
Now, wait a minute. Is the show, and I mean the actual, not the show within a show, the show itself, episodes, is this, did you say it's an adaptation? Are they porting over something from Britain?
I don't think so. If anything, it's a little bit inspired by Entourage. It's a little bit inspired by the TV set, I believe.
Right.
Because
okay.
It's one of those behind the scenes, how television gets horribly mangled in the process of making it.
I think people have actually mentioned, maybe that's why it's being recommended to me so much, because I've talked about the TV set the other day, and I think a lot of people have said in their emails to me, you know, if you like the show, if you like the movie, the TV set, you got to watch the show episodes. So have you started watching it?
I have watched the first episode, and that's the whole thing where they put this brilliant actor through the paces of having to audition for his own role.
Right.
And then, of course, them just saying, I don't know, I think he's a little English, you know, because he's playing the headmaster at a boarding school, but he's a little too English. And then they decide at the very end of the first episode, they suggest, we have this great actor that we think would be perfect for the part, though. He's a very famous television actor, and he's ready to get back into TV. Matt LeBlanc. And that's kind of where the first episode ends, with them just staring at each other blankly, like at the conference call on the telephone, just like, you know. So, and it was quite funny, and I think it's going to actually turn out to be quite good. I'm looking forward to watching more of it. But all of you people who keep emailing me, okay, I'm watching it now.
See, that's my thing. Is
so
like,
stop.
I don't want to sound like I'm ungrateful, because I appreciate, because any number of the things that I watch or read or enjoy, everything from food to film and beyond, you know, comes recommended by somebody, the things that you've sort of pressed me to watch, and I do, and I say, my God, it was, you know, I can't believe that I lived for 37 years never having seen whatever. Like Toy Story 3, which I would probably still be just sitting there, because here's the thing about movies, is now we've reached that point where, like, the nag be gone that you can use is the, it's in my queue. You know, and that just sort of means, like, I'll get to it someday. Get off my jock. I'll watch it someday. Just please quit asking me about it. So when you tell somebody something is in your Netflix queue, maybe it's a lie, maybe it's not. The upshot is the same. You're not watching it tonight. You know, it's like whatever you were already planning on watching, like, that's going to stay job one for you. And it's like the other thing is just you're going to get to that whenever. But, of course, that's when you ask your mom, like, can Bobby sleep over? She goes, I'll think about it, which means no. I'll think about it means no. I'll call you sometime means I'm never calling you. I'm living the dream means your life sucks. And it's in my queue means I'm smiling and nodding and disregarding your suggestion. So that's what I've told people. Like, it's in my queue. So no offense, everybody who's recommended that, but I've just been lying straight out.
Well, if it turns out to be just amazing,
let me know.
You should watch it. I'll let you know. Right now, the first episode was cute. It was amusing.
Hey. I'm sorry to mean to say idea. If this was a if this was a cartoon, there'd be the like either the light bulb or the Great Gazoo floating next to me right now. You know what we ought to do? I have a great idea, and this is not like most of my great ideas, where great is a euphemism for stupid. This is really a great idea, because
I think Cheryl will be the judge of that, as she always is.
Yeah. If that's the case, then I really know what the verdict is going to be, because the verdict is always the verdict is always the same thing. Because you and I are constantly getting things sort of recommended to us, and you know we're not the only people like this, but you know because because we're sort of out there in a public sense in some way, and a lot of people, you know, they know that we're consumers of media, and they say, hey, well, here's a thing you ought to enjoy, but it's like there's just too much, not enough time. We should do this. You and I should alternate taking the bullet on a recommendation and then letting the other person know if it's worth their while. So, like, you watch episodes, you watch, like, 2-3 installments of that and let me know if it's good. And then when somebody else says, no, but let me just tell you, Richard Grieco, he's got a new project. I know what you're thinking, but it's great. And then so I say, well, that's, but I don't want to watch a Richard Grieco show, but it would be my turn. And so I would watch it and I would get, I don't know, maybe an episode or two in, enough to let you, Dawn, know whether or not it ought to be watched. I think
someone says, no, seriously, you have never seen Lorenzo Lamas like this before.
Exactly. So that's a thing. No, that's totally a thing that we should do. So whatever the next thing is, but it's got to be something that like several people have recommended. It can't just be like some guy somewhere, you know, who wants me to go back and watch No Soap Radio again or something, because that's probably not going to happen.
Oh, by the way, we really should mention again, I don't have the date in front of me. We should start really pointing out that the Sleep Country Pajama Bowl is coming up. I completely.
We mentioned, I keep forgetting about that.
We mentioned that was happening and that they put together a team, our fine
for
listeners.
Children.
And it's for the children. And then I just went completely out of my head until I saw something on TV about it. And I was like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
Pajama Bowl.
No, I'm a. Okay. Because
it's in like a week or something. Or is it this week? I don't know when it is.
No, I'm an awful person. Cheryl will send me an excoriating message any moment now.
But we have to tell people that maybe later in this episode, we will point you at the page for where you can like sign up and help out our team for Sleep Country Pajama Bowl.
Well, because that's just one of those things where I feel now especially guilty. Like I have all this the Catholic guilt times like 10, because not only first of all, we started doing that Sleep Country thing back when we were I think at Entercom, and then it became a thing we did at CBS, and so it's for children. I mean, it's for charity and for children. And it's a thing that normally requires me putting on zany pajamas and then going and bowling. And so the last, like, 2 years, I haven't had to do really either of those. I had to put on the pajamas, but I basically just went and stood there while other people exercised on my behalf. And then I still got the credit for it. And also last year, they just sort of did it.
Yeah.
When I say without being asked, I don't mean like I would have asked them to do it. I would not have expected that. Rick Emerson wouldn't have any such sort of presumption. They just sort of did it, like, of their own volition. Like, we will now raise money for children on Rick Emerson's behalf. He won't have to do anything. Like, who really... In the grand scheme of things, that really is about as great as a favor can get. That's like the best thing that can be done.
And beat out several local TV stations and radio stations that had far more like firepower behind them and should have been able to like just rake in lots and lots of donations and did not. But no,
well,
the Emerson team. Was triumphant.
To be fair, most of the Clear Channel team was actually in Houston. They were just pretending to be here bowling.
Oh, yeah.
All right. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. Author Bill Carter going to be joining us here in just a few. We've also got a Taser Watch coming up. We'll talk Breaking Bad. We've got an installment of the greatest songs ever made and clue number 3 for the E.H. Vending Name That Snack contest. That is all on the way, ladies and gentlefolk. Without further ado, I haven't even asked you. God damn, I suck. I haven't even asked you about seeing Burlesque.
Oh,
which you saw like a week ago now.
Yeah.
And I've been every day. You're like, we wrap up the show, and you're like, but Burlesque. And I say, don't tell me. We'll wait. We'll talk about it on the show because I'm a terrible actor.
Well, considering there's no time thing about that. We don't really have to talk about that right now. Plus the fact I've been thinking about, I'm going to put together I told Sarah that I would put together like a burlesque showing at my home on the giant TV, and she was like, oh, really? And
but
I was like, yeah.
That's probably just going to be for ladies.
Well, you could come. I think you would enjoy it.
Really? Is that how I'm viewed? Really? Okay,
ladies,
I understand.
Ladies and you.
That just tells
you
me, you
are
know,
just a big girl. You know it.
I'm one of the gals.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks. That's exactly how every guy wants to be viewed. No. No, he's basically a eunuch. No, he's just got a smooth plastic area down there.
No, he likes Christina Aguilera. He'd have a good time.
Yeah, that's
He'll
great.
Drink a wine spritzer.
That's fantastic. Well, as Siegfried would say, let's blue sky that, and we'll come back to it. It is 503-505-6964. So at some point, we'll talk about burlesque, only because, not because it's like there's a time element,
no.
But just because I do really want to know what you thought about it, and I've been deliberately avoiding all of the conversations you've had with other people, because then it's like, I don't want to come up pretend that I don't know or anything. So you got that, and then last night you saw some Farrelly Brothers thing,
right,
and who knew they were still making movies?
Yeah, I saw Hall Pass, which Patrick came with me, and I kept trying to disabuse him of this, saying, have you seen the ads? He's like, yeah. And I'm going, it's going to be really bad. He goes, yeah, but I haven't seen a movie in a while. I'm going, yeah, but this isn't going to be a good movie. This is going to be a bad movie. He's like, yeah, but I'd really like to, you know, get out and go to a movie. And we got there, and I swear to God, the credits started rolling, and it came up, and it said it was written by the Farrelly Brothers. He goes, oh, come on.
Didn't he know?
Didn't you tell? And I'm like, oh, I failed to mention that.
Oh.
And apparently me just going, it's going to suck. It's going to suck. It's going to suck. It's going to suck. Have you seen the commercials? It's going to suck.
See?
Over and over.
You deliberately withheld the fact that it was a Farrelly Brothers film.
I kind of forgot myself.
Did he not ask any additional information about the film?
No, he just saw it. He said, well, Jason Sudeikis was in it, and Owen Wilson has been in some bad movies, but he's been in some good movies.
You could have been taking him to the movie starring the Fandango paper bags, for all you know. He didn't ask any. He was just like so desperate. You've got a television the size of a car.
Yeah, but
what is he trying to leave the house for?
No, he drives around all day and talks to his ladies.
Yeah.
Because he makes deliveries at dental offices all around the Portland metro area. And so he has like this harem of dental assistants and people that he sees every day. And he's got that whole delivery guy mystique going on that's like, hey, Patrick's here. We like Patrick.
Hard to believe nobody ever wrote a song about that.
And one of his things, I guess, is I'm hoping they like it when he talks about movies he got to see early.
A harem of dental assistants.
Yeah. These
dental assistants like secretaries or like the chick that comes in and puts the apron on your junk?
Well, you know, when it's like the whoever's working at the front desk and sometimes he actually talks to the dentists themselves, but mostly he deals with the front desk staff and stuff at these dental offices. So it's like the receptionist and the dental assistants and those folks. And I guess he gets flirted with a lot, and he's a nice looking enough man. But he also has that delivery guy mystique.
Does he wear a uniform?
He does.
What's his uniform?
Well, it's khaki pants and an orange shirt that says O'Brien Dental on it.
Really? Is
yeah.
it like written in script on the boob?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sexy.
And when the weather's cold, he has a navy blue jacket that also has the name and script.
Well, see, the
on
navy
it.
Blue works though. See, that's a thing. Yeah.
But he's got that because I know I used to work at an office and there is that thing that when like the UPS guy or the FedEx person shows up and everybody's like, ooh, it's the UPS guy. You know, it's like this little moment of your day.
No, it's true because I will tell you this, that I used to work in an office where the UPS person was a woman. And so the UPS chick would show up and she was, and here's the thing, she was, when I say middling hot, I don't mean she was unattractive, but I mean she wasn't anything special. She was, you know, cute, but I mean, but it was like, I tell you, there was something about that UPS uniform. It did render her hotter. Somehow. And then plus, you lie to your... this sounds dumb even saying it, but then you think they have like a really exotic life somehow.
Yeah.
What an exciting life that must be, being a UPS driver. And really, they're just going to like drop off golf balls at like some guy's shop.
And it's like the barista thing. They come in and they're friendly to you and then they're gone.
Yeah.
But you see them on a regular basis. You see them almost daily. So in a way, you have a relationship with them. But not really. But there's kind of that
this sounds
illusion
so sad.
Of
it's
a
almost
relationship.
Like you're, it's like talking about a guy who gets a hooker, because he needs to have somebody to talk to.
But part of his thing is that, of course, they all know that, you know, he's married to someone who is a film critic and sees movies early. So they'll say, you seen any movies lately? And he'll say, oh, yes, I saw that Harry Potter movie like a week before everybody else. And they'll go, how is it? And he can tell them.
He's a player.
So even if the movie sucks, then he can say, oh, God, I saw this.
I know people.
Oh, stay away from that. It's bad. You know, and that
he can
part,
be a maven.
Right. And he enjoys that.
So, but the lights go down. He somehow didn't know it was a Farrelly Brothers film. And then it said, written by the Farrelly Brothers. And did he just look at you and just go, what are you doing?
Exactly. He literally, and I am not kidding, he actually did this. He just spun around towards me and went, oh, come on! Seriously? And I was like, I thought you knew. I'm sorry.
A dumb question. Was it terrible?
It wasn't terrible. It just, I mean, I've seen terrible, and believe me, it wasn't terrible. It was just really stupid. I think it's the Farrelly brothers trying to do an Apatow movie. So it's more in that vein of, boy, guys sure are idiots, and they like to talk about sex in crude ways.
But they just want to be loved.
But, yeah, and then the ladies say, I'll tell you what, you get a week off and you can do anything you want because we know you won't actually get laid.
Yeah.
And then you'll come crawling back to us and the guys go, woohoo, we get to get laid. And then, of course, they can't get laid because they're big dumbasses. And you go, wow, men sure are dumb.
But charming.
And like, oh, look, someone's pooping, you know, because it's a Farrelly Brothers
movie. There
should
totally be a movie called Oh, Look, Someone's Pooping.
Because it wouldn't be a Farrelly Brothers movie without bodily function humor.
You could probably release that as a film. The MPAA probably couldn't have anything to say about that. Oh, look, someone's pooping. Starring Rob Schneider.
Written by Peter and Bobby Farrelly.
Seriously. Oh, man, I almost want to go, like, register that with the Writers Guild, like, right now.
Oh, God.
Oh, awesome.
And then the screening was sponsored by KUFO.
But that wasn't awkward.
So, and I'm saying that, you know, Guns N' Roses has its place. But when I'm sitting in a Regal Cinema, forced to sit there waiting for a movie to start, and Paradise City is being blasted me, and then followed by, hey, this is Ricker. How you want to win the snowboarding tickets? And it's like, God, and then I know I'm about to see a Farrelly Brothers movie, and then Pork Chop shows up.
Best night ever.
Pork Chop comes in, and he's giving out concert tickets, and I'm like, I actually tweeted that. I just said, kill me.
Were they flinging T-shirts into the audience?
No, thank God. They did the thing where they taped stuff under the seats and people had to go up in an orderly fashion to get their crap.
I would say the lowest moment of your life in radio is when you were just sitting there throwing T-shirts in the audience.
And the asking moronic trivia questions for prizes.
By the way, always make sure that you're asking those trivia questions on an underpowered PA or just shouting them at the front where no one can actually hear you. And you have to go, what? Did you?
Yeah.
No, it's Batman Return? No, this guy's... Hello? Anyone? And meanwhile, everybody's just, like, hating you because they want the movie to start.
Yeah. And make sure they're either, A, questions that everyone knows the answer to, so then you still just have to randomly pick a person to throw the T-shirt at, or B, no one knows the answer to because it's about the movie they haven't seen yet.
Damn. I remember just sitting there, like, at the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull or whatever, where it's like, you know, and at that point, I'm 35 years of age or something and achieved some modest amount of success, you know, and I'm not an intern anymore. I'm not some weekender. I'm not having to go do like a sticker stop at a tire store. But then it's like you ask yourself, how many rungs above that am I really? Because I'm at a theater in Tigard throwing T-shirts at morons, you know, that's where you go home at night. You just like look in the mirror and you go like, what am I?
Yeah, I would have felt just sort of anger and loathing for Pork Chop. Except for the
anger
fact
and
that,
loathing for Pork Chop.
Except that I, you know, I've heard that he's actually a very nice guy.
Well, and he's had some difficulties.
I was feeling sorry for him because he had to do this. Because honestly, it seems to me most of the time when I go to these screenings, they don't have the on-air talent doing this crap.
No,
they have like the street team who do this stuff, and it's like maybe they are going through some serious budget cuts at KUFO if they've got somebody who's actually on the air showing up in Tigard to give out, like, you know, concert tickets before a Farrelly Brothers movie.
I could say more, but it would be, I don't know, I'll just say we're over time. That'll be my excuse. It's a few minutes after six, so, and this is all true. Hey, I'm failing on the alliteration I was going to do. Confidential to Kanakoa in, or whatever.
Kansas.
No, but she's in Beaverton is the thing.
Oh.
I did not think, Cheryl, if you can hear me right now.
Cheryl, if you can hear me.
I don't know the issue with the Willamette Week and with Aaron Mesh and or Kelly Clark. And there was a number coming up just now that I think actually I missed and it went to voicemail. So I do not know whether we are supposed to be talking to Willamette Week right around now or not. But we're probably not going to be able to do it until later on in the show because we're going to go to break. Bill Carter's going to be here. I will... I'm just using the radio as a personal communication device right now. So I'm gonna, I will get in touch with the break and try to figure everything out. But if you happen to be listening, just know that I'm gonna be calling you so we can sort all that out. I don't wanna be like a jackass if somebody's calling and then it's going to voicemail. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Bill Carter around the corner. Clue number three for the EH Vending Name That Snack Contest coming up. Taser Watch, greatest songs ever made, and more. Stay there. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Extravaganza and Cavalcade of Amusements. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network. just the road and its majesty. And I'm looking at you with the world in the rear view. You were pleased to be sitting in the front seat, looking at me, telling me you love me and you're happy to be with me on the 4th of July. We sang, sang a pole till the stereo couldn't take no more of that rock and roll. So we put on a little George Jones and just sang along. Hey! Those white lines can draw into the sun. If you ain't got no one to keep you hanging on, but there you were, like a queen in your nightgown, riding shotgun from town to town, staking a claim on the world we found. And I'm singing to you, you're singing to me. You were out of the blue to a boy like me. You were pretty as can be, sitting in the front seat, looking at me, telling me you love me and you're happy to be with me on the 4th of July. We sang, sang a low till the stereo couldn't take no more of that rock and roll. So we put on a little George Jones and just sang along. Sang along. In the silence that we shared, you were pretty as can be, sitting in the front seat, looking at me, telling me you love me and you're happy to be with me on the 4th of July. We sang, sang a low till the stereo couldn't take no more of that rock and roll. So we put on a little George Jones and just sang along.
He stopped loving her.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. In just a moment, we'll be joined by Mr. Bill Carter. Coming up later on today, we got your Taser Watch on the way. Also, clue number three for the E.H. Vending Name That Snack Contest. We'll talk Breaking Bad with Don Taylor and another installment of the greatest songs ever made. That is all on the horizon. Isn't it, Don Taylor?
God, I hope so.
Let's see. We have this question, which I will throw to you for no readily apparent reason, except that I'm not prepared to answer it definitively. Question, why do white people think that khaki pants go with everything and every color? Please to explain. Dawn Taylor in the back.
I blame men in the 40s. Humphrey Bogart, John Wayne, Robert Mitchum. They could, like, pull off the khaki pants in any situation and look kind of suave.
So is this a thing that worked for one guy one time at some point in American history, and then now everyone says, I will Xerox that look badly for the rest of my days?
I think there's also this mistaken belief that khaki pants, like pleated khakis, look good on any body type.
See, that's, okay, here's the thing about that. Do you remember this time, you know, like Portlandia had that whole, like, dream of the 90s thing? You know what I think of when I think of the 90s? It's not even really the grunge deal and the guy with the knotted flannel shirt. I think about the thing where everybody dressed like a Kinko's employee, where everybody had khaki pants and then, like, what is it, like a blue denim work shirt sort of a thing?
Yeah.
And it's like just everywhere you went, a guy, it didn't matter where, what kind of job, you know, what do? I work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and also I'm a quantum physicist, and I dress like I'm at Kinko's. And they, it was that one outfit they issued to every guy.
And in their minds, they all looked like Mark Harmon or John Kitzhaber.
Exactly. Here's the other thing about that. You're saying that you blame the khakis thing on the Humphrey Bogart guys. You know what else I blame on that? And look, this is like last hour when we were talking about the gamer funk, like guys who play a lot of Magic the Gathering, and clearly hygiene is not job one or job 78. The thing about gamers is the fedora looks dumb. Let's just, I hate to say that. I mean, and I'm not just trying to pick on gamers with that, but they are the group most likely. Gamers or somebody who is involved in one or more improv groups at a local dramatist's guild. Those are the guys, and it's like
You have to be a handsome guy to pull off certain hat styles. You know, it's you have to either be a handsome guy or a really goofy-looking guy. You can't be anything in between. Like, you can be kind of a chubby, goofy-looking guy and wear a pork pie hat. Or you can be, like, a really cool, good-looking, skinny hipster guy and wear a pork pie hat. But if you're just some normal schlub and you put on a pork pie hat,
schlub,
you just look like a dork.
Well, here's the other thing about the hat, wearing that the fedora, is that that is always worn by a guy where it's like his other, like, he's wearing, like, a Roswell shirt, you know? And then just, like, stained pants and then, like, you know, and then like some shoes that he got from the Value Village. So it really, it's got to be part of a whole ensemble, as they say. It's got to be, you've got to really sell it by making it part of a look.
I've always wondered what it is with balding Jewish guys and Russian fishermen's caps.
They see, here's the thing, they totally make that work. Here's it, because there's...
But where was that memo? That because I actually dated a bearded, balding Jewish guy once who wore the fisherman's cap.
Is that the beginning to a joke?
No. Many of my anecdotes start with I dated a guy once, because really.
Did he not wear the hat?
No, he wore the hat.
Oh, you're wondering how he figured it out.
Yeah.
Like, was it handed down father to son, and now I give you the hat.
It's such a common thing.
Well, you know, here's the thing. No, it's like the whole deal of like, it's like any, you pick any piece of clothing or any sort of outfit, and you put it on me, and then you put it on like an equivalent, an equivalently aged and sized black man. It will always, I mean, it's like the black guy's always going to have 70 times the style that I do. And I think it's because I've just got just some sort of inherent lameness that's sort of a, you know, it's like those days where you think that nobody's going to notice that maybe you've skipped a shower or something, and you're just going to put a little extra hair gel in. You go, well, it's pretty much the same thing. It's not the same thing. Even if people aren't consciously aware of it, there's something going on underneath the surface. You know, there's some sort of aesthetic subtlety that indicates to them that you're just filthy. And so I think it is with the clothing, where it's like I put something on that should look cool, and it's like I just look like a tool. And yet, I'm in like 2 weeks ago. I'm in Northeast Portland. Lara and I were going to like get an omelet or something. Or some speaking of being lame and white, I was going to get myself some brunch. And but it was Sunday, and so it's like, you know, the folks in their Sunday best. Mm. And it was like family's coming out of church, and it's like, you know, mom, dad, the daughter, and then this kid. He couldn't have been more than like six. And he's like the most styling kid, and he's doing the whole thing. He's like he's got his Sunday outfit on. But he's taken the jacket and he's totally hooked the jacket over the shoulder with the one finger. And he's like six, and he's thrown the jacket over the shoulder, and he's, I won't say that it was a strut, but it was a walk of a certain confidence. It was a walk indicating that he knew the style and panache with which he was, that he was projecting. And I just, I can't do that. I don't know what we were talking about here. Well, speaking of old Jewish guys and fishermen, I guess that's what's going to pass for a clumsy segue at this point of the program. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson radio program, the author of Fools Rush In, also the man behind the film Miss Sarajevo, and the author of Red Summer, The Danger and Madness of Commercial Fishing in Alaska, Mr. Bill Carter. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. Now, you've been in the studio. We were talking about this morning. You've been in the studio before. You've been on with Sarah and Greg, and I guess we just missed each other or whatever the last time you were here, because I couldn't quite figure out we were talking about your last appearance at Fun Employment, and I couldn't figure out if it was we were in this studio or if it was still when Greg and Sarah were doing it out of his, like, hovel of a home, which I say with all the affection in the world. But it was just – it was like all of the universe's assembled filth had been put into one small room, and that room was at Greg Nibbler's house. So so you are here talking about – you're going to be here you're here in Portland, and then you're going to be in Astoria Friday and Saturday,
right.
And you're going to be showing this short film based on Red Summer, and then you're going to be reading from it as well. So we've got some events that we'll talk about here in just a second. I don't even know where to begin with this except to say that, and I think I mentioned this morning, that I had the copy of Red Summer, which I got from the publisher because I'd given mine to my brother. And I opened it about, I don't know, 10, 12 days ago, and I'd started reading it, and then something sort of interrupted it for a couple of days. And then I made the mistake of opening it a second time at like 2 in the morning. And that's the thing where you look up and it's 4:30 or 5 in the morning and you're just zen with the fact that you're going to get no sleep because the book is – it really is amazing. It really is just – it really is gripping. And I think a lot of people see – like they watch whatever, like the Deadliest Catch or whatever. And I'm not – and I don't – I'm assuming that that show is pretty on the level. But I also know that that's a show where you see one part of it. You see 100th. Of what happens when you're there. And what they never show on a program like Deadliest Catch, for the most part, you see any of those documentaries, and again, I'm sure that they're pretty representative of a certain slice of that existence. But in one of those Alaskan fishing villages, what they never say is, well, here's the hard-drinking, fast-and-loose-with-the-rules edgy guy who's out there, and he's in this dangerous profession, he's making a lot of money and embracing the elements. But they never tell you, like, well, what does that guy do, 20 years later? You know, what does that guy look like 35 years later? What is going on in that guy's past that brought him to be at that place? And that's a whole separate part of the story, which is just as fascinating. You were in Arizona. You were in Tucson, I guess, when the call came to go work.
I was actually in Chico, California.
Chico, California, when the call came to go work in the Alaskan fishing village. Tell me a little bit about how that happened. It was a friend of a friend. Got your name somehow.
Yeah, I'd worked a lot in the film business as an assistant director, and so the girl who recommended me, Cindy Rhodes, she knew me from that time. And so when she got a call from Sharon Hart, who is the fishing captain in Alaska, and said, you know what, I got a person that went down, injury, I need someone tomorrow. Cindy went through her database and in her mind and said, well, Bill will do it, he can handle it. And so I got the phone call from Sharon. It was pretty much a cold call. She told me she knew Cindy, but, she was looking for someone that would be kind of a mix of stupid enough and eager enough and...
healed quickly.
Yeah. And, it's this unspoken thing. This is a very tricky thing for captains looking for crew. They do it all year long. And it's very tricky because what you can't say... when you're kind of always looking for someone that's going to be a good crew, is you can't say is because if you have to say it, then it's already not going to work. Is you have to say what you want to say is you can never whine.
Right. There's no complaining.
You can never complain. But if you have to say that to a person, usually you're saying it to a person who might complain.
Right.
So it's you have to take this faith like I'm looking at this guy, I'm feeling this guy out, I'm hearing him on the phone, I'm hearing him. He's not complaining. He's not whinging already. So I'll take that person on. And if they start to whine, well, then there's consequences, usually very fast.
Sharon Hart, who's the woman in Red Summer, is a lot of stories intertwined. And one of them is the story of your experience there. It's also the story of the creation of, and I had this pronunciation down. I had this pronunciation down flawlessly this morning. It was Igiki. Igiik. Sorry. Yeah. The village of Igiik. But it's sort of how it came to be and how those towns develop. But it's also a lot about Sharon Hart, who faces any number. I mean, the job is hard and difficult and the elements are unforgiving, but also being a woman in what is traditionally and overwhelmingly a male field. But you tell this story about trying to sleep, and it's one of those things where she's, on the floor above you in the house and just made these sort of moans of pain that apparently could just happen every night. Mm-hmm. And she tells you at one point that she can no longer feel anything below her elbows. That's just – 5 years ago, she stopped feeling anything below her elbows. How long does it take before the job – before the toll is irreversible, the physical toll?
It doesn't take long. I still have injuries that I have. Sharon, in Sharon's case, you know, this will be her 33rd year this year, straight fishing. She finally had the carpal tunnel surgery, which helped her, but she's still numb. You know, if you see her, her forearms and her hands are kind of curled up like a rheumatoid arthritis person would be. I mean, she's got huge forearms. You know, fishing is something that it takes very little time to take a toll on you. Maybe 2-3 seasons, and you're pretty much something's wrong with you. Tendons, shoulder, rotifery, you know, the rotary cuff, back. If you work, if you're fishing in a good fishery, you're going to get injured.
I think she actually handed you, in addition to the, I mentioned actually in the beginning of the show, I was telling the story about the phone call where she said not to have any buttons and nothing sort of dangled off because you were going to get, you know, whisked off the side of the boat by the net. I think in the book you mentioned that she, one of the first things she did was to give you a tube of super glue. And she's like, this is the thing that you're going to use to heal up, like you're, you know, your hands are going to get busted up. And so just something starts to bleed, you just glue it shut and, you know, just go on about your business.
It's kind of like the army, you know, in the war. I mean, that's where super glue came from. It's where duct tape come from. And in, when you fish, all the places on your hand where your joint, or like your finger joints are, all those will start to bleed and crack. Deep, deep cuts and cracks. And because you're grabbing the net,
right,
and it falls into that spot. And so you're going to have deep, almost, you know, really deep cuts, and it's going to cause a lot of pain. So the super glue helps, doesn't heal it, but it stops the bleeding. And it's, more importantly, what you don't want to have happen is you don't want to have fish guts and gur, as they call it, go into there, because fish poisoning of the hand is extremely painful, very toxic. So you don't want to have that happen. That's why you're sealing those cracks.
How many people make it through the first? I mean, because you got to get the these guys who show up, you know, because they, we were talking about this in the monologue, the people who hear from a buddy of theirs are like, yeah, no, I went up there and it's great money. No, it's, you know, it's like 6 weeks of work and you come back with 50 grand. And then you get there and you realize it's like, you go like, I'm in hell. Like, this is what, why am I here? How many guys just wash out in the first, you know, in the first week?
Most of them. It's a washout place. It really is. It takes like one shift, you know, of a 10,000 pound day to realize whether you're going to be able to do this or whether you can't do it. And it happens very quick, within hours, a day, 2 days, you know that you can't do it.
And then once you're there and it's like, you know, you either decide that it's not for you or the captain is just like you suck, you got to, you know, go home.
Right.
As you said, the exclamation of get the F off my boat is not that uncommon. And then you're just in this place, this town. I mean, to call it a strange and battered outpost is, I think, to not even really explain the gravity of how serious it can be to then find yourself with no money, no job, in a place where there is only one job to get, you know, and you're $400 and however many thousands of miles from home.
Yeah, we were talking earlier, one of the most interesting things about this place for me as a writer was that, you know, from Sacramento Airport, the first flight you can get, it will take you 12 hours to get to Icky Gick. That's if everything goes really smooth. Usually it's 2 days. You know, and it's three plane rides. You know, and each plane ride becomes smaller so that you're the co-pilot on the last plane ride, holding the mail, you know. And it's one of these things that you're so far removed from what we think is America, you think you're not maybe in America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is like Siberia or something. You're so far out there, and yet you're still inside this country. But yet all the things that govern this country on a day-to-day basis for us do not exist there at all.
Well, and you hear the phrase that it's like a town without laws and it's a lawless sort of a place. Most places where they talk about being lawless, it just means that, like, it takes the cops a few extra minutes to show up,
right.
You know? Or, like, they're going to have to bust in the crack house down the street before they come and sort out whatever you and your girlfriend have got going on in the house. But in these fishing villages, there is literally there is no law enforcement presence because it's hours away.
Yeah.
And so it becomes this sort of, you know, it's like a frontier. It's a frontier justice almost.
It's very much frontier justice. You know, there's a bad side. There's an ugly side to all these native villages, and most of it is related to alcohol. You know, the last season I was there, we went to a party almost toward the end of the season. We knew everybody there. It's a very small kind of family, even though it's maybe 1,000 people during fishing season. And, you know, words got exchanged, things went on. Somebody pulled out a gun and shot at somebody. Now, the guy who shot at him, the police, the state troopers couldn't get there till the next day. By that time, he'd already gotten his boat and was driving out toward, like, Dutch Harbor, toward Russia. You know, he was already on his way. And, you know, the state troopers aren't going to chase him. They're like, well, okay, we'll get him when he gets back. Because where's he going to go?
Right.
He doesn't know anything else. Because
he doesn't
come home.
Because he'll show back up at some point because he doesn't because that is the life that is the life that he is
his
equipped
family's
for.
There.
Else. Is,
yeah, exactly. So, but you know, a lot of problems in the winter go on there, and it takes a long time. And there is definitely a family village justice that can happen to people that isn't pretty. Until the cops come.
Alaska has not only, I think in the book you note that it's the highest rate of alcoholism, the highest rate of suicide, and also and sexual assault, rape, higher than anywhere else in the country, which I don't know where I thought it was, but I don't think I would have picked Alaska.
Right.
And it's one of those things where probably a guy doesn't get too many strikes. He doesn't get too many chances before they just decide that, you know, something's got to get handled.
Well, it used to be a long time ago that it was one of those things that happened sometimes in families where it wasn't spoken about. Like, you knew the uncle, you know, Fester was fiddling.
Right.
And it was kind of one of those things that was ugly and not nice to talk about, but no one did anything about it. Those times are changing. People really are looking out after their daughters. And so now you can be beaten to death. You know, so it depends on the village. It depends on the vibe, but it definitely is. There's a lot more eyes upon people now.
Of the people, I don't even know if you can come up with a percentage for this, but of the people who are there, is it a sizable percentage that are there because they are running from something else? Either whether it's actually running from the law or whether there's just something that they are trying to leave behind mentally and they want to go to a place that is just, you know, they want to wash everything clean. They just want to start over.
I think that a lot of people start fishing like that. I think a lot of people that are captains today, 30 years in, start like that. You know, like whatever. Maybe they're young and they don't know where to go. Maybe, you know, they have some bad debts or whatever it is. But, you know, once they establish themselves as fishermen, and they clear up that part of their life, you know, they might live down here in the Northwest. Then they could keep fishing. They kind of clear that up, and now Alaska becomes a different part of their life that's almost like a split life. It isn't running away at that point. But every year there's new crew guys are always – you kind of wonder what's going on. Some of them come from fishing families, and that's, you know, incredibly obvious the moment they touch a boat. And then some of them are you don't really know what's going on with them. And they might not even talk about it, you know. I mean, I've met many people on the lam up there, you know, running from – you know, most of it's really lame, like the running from child.
So they get alimony they don't want to pay.
They don't pay their alimony. And, you know, and there's a really well-known thing amongst parolees. If you jump to Alaska, Alaska is not going to foot the bill to put you on a plane to go back to Montana for child – for not paying your alimony. So unless it's, you know, a pretty big crime – and the other state's not going to pay for you.
Yeah, unless you're Lee Harvey Oswald, Nebraska's not going to come looking for you.
Well, they're just not going to pay the plane ride. So a lot of guys or women or whoever, they jump to Alaska to kind of get away from the low ball parole. You know?
You mentioned kids, and I just can't imagine. I mean, everybody goes, like, my hometown was terrible. It was, you have no, but I can't imagine what it's like to grow up in a place like that where that is. You know, if you're an adult and you opt into that, and that becomes the world you know, and the only job that you, after a time that you can do, that's one thing. At least it was your own choice. I can't fathom being born in one of these tiny fishing communities in Southwest Alaska, and that's your figurative horizon. I mean, if kids are born there, do they leave very often, or do they just end up staying and like that's just what they do?
You know, they used to always stay and fish and become fishermen. That's who's there now. And they're always great fishermen, and I get along with them great. In today's world, most kids are sent away at a certain age because parents want them to, you know, have this kind of rich, natural life of their village, aside from the things we've been talking about. But there's also a beautiful side to it, fishing and the community. So, but they send them to school, and most kids, if they're native, go to Sitka, which is in Alaska, that's where the native school is. That's where they can go for free. So they go to Sitka, and usually there's family to stay with, or they go to Anchorage, and they kind of have a different life, and they might come back, but they might not. They might just go on and do other things in Alaska or somewhere else. So that's kind of also changing. Which is also a little sad part to that is that you don't really have the tradition now of passing on the fishing. It's there, but it's not as big as it used to be.
We're talking to Bill Carter. The book is Red Summer, The Danger and Madness of Commercial Salmon Fishing in Alaska. In just a moment, we'll talk about the events coming up in Astoria. And we'll talk about the Pebble Mine thing, too. And this is... I won't pretend that I haven't asked you some of these questions already because we did an interview for Outlook Portland this morning. But it's fascinating because Portland is such a progressive, politically active town in some ways. And I don't mean this as a knock, but a lot of times it's a thing where people will hear a little thumbnail sketch about something and they'll make a decision or they'll take a sort of stance of advocacy or opposition without really getting a sense of what they're actually talking about. And I'm no different. So it was interesting to hear you talk about the Pebble Mine, which is a thing that there's a lot of opposition to here, and to really give sort of a more rounded take on why it may not be such a good idea. So we'll talk about that in just one second. But I wanted to ask you about this phrase in the book. You start off one of the later chapters by saying, this is a quote, "Every season we almost drown. It's inevitable. There is always one time when everything turns against us, forcing us to use all the skills we've learned to escape." And yet you're there for not just one summer or two, but four. And I think for me, I think it's like one near drowning, two at the most. That's enough for me to say, like, maybe not for me. Maybe I'll go mow lawns somewhere. So what is it that kept you – what is it that kept you going back?
What keeps me going back and maybe go back in the future is two things. Or maybe more, but two things off the top of my head is one is the people. I'm totally enamored, especially maybe as a writer, maybe just as a human being, with people that are put in positions that force them to be themselves. You know, not unlike the other book, Fools Rush In. You know, war has a way of stripping down all the nonsense. You know what I mean? Like, you might be on the radio right now, and you might be this and that. But when it comes to a war, and you have to get the water, I have to get the water, I'm going to find out who you are.
Right.
In fishing, you might come in there with a lot of swag, and you might leave there with your crying.
Right.
Or you might come in there really quiet and be like the most incredible, like the guy we all rely on. So I'm always... By the time you get to a fishing camp, there's so many of these people have proved this stuff over years that when you meet them, they kind of who they are. They are who they are. You know, there's no fashion. You know, everybody's wearing sweatpants and hoodies, and that's
right.
It.
There's no pretense.
No, and they're, if they're there long enough, that means they work really hard. And they might be liars. They might be cheats. They might be people you would never ever know in your life back down here. But for that time, it's very fascinating to watch people be in a community and be willing to help. You know, fishermen are a very selfish tribe. They generally kind of want everything they can get out of the sea. However, and that's how they act toward each other, and there's a lot of battles on the fishing. There's not a lot of help. But if you have trouble one night, if you have a problem, you know, whatever it is, they're all going to help you. It's bizarre. They're not going to help you at all if you're fishing, you know, side by side,
right,
catching fish. But the moment your rudder is, you know, your prop is dead, you're drifting, they'll be right there.
There's a temptation, I think, in the media sometimes to depict struggling or independent fishermen as these sort of guardians of nature. Your perspective on it, you make it very clear that the fishermen in Alaska have this very zero-sum game attitude about the industry. I think you actually said at one point that if there were no checks on fishing, that they would fish the place dry. I mean, they would fish it to the point that the fish were gone.
Fishermen, it's not something you can control. I'm a person who's extremely conscious of, you know, the sea, the balance, and, you know, I don't even fish anymore, even though I grew up fishing. And if I do, I catch one fish and I make sure I eat it. But, you know, on a good day in Alaska, I might catch 30,000 pounds. And it's something that it does affect you. But while you're fishing, there's something going on where you're just going to get it all. Now, that said, there's a lot of talk about the fisheries of the world and the sea, and especially in the Northwest where you lost your runs all the way down to San Francisco. And as much as I knock fishing game around the country, which they take knocks for good reasons, they usually don't do things right. The fishing game in Bristol Bay has done a phenomenal job of controlling this run from fishermen overfishing it. And the fishermen at this stage in this you know, fishery have begun to realize the MB, and they thank fishing game for helping you know, stop themselves.
Right.
And they're very aware of it. And part of that comes because the fines are so massive and so immediate. You know, if you screw up out there, you know, they might drop a helicopter on you on the water and give you $10,000 fine. And you can't fish again until you pay that fine at King Salmon.
And if you're a guy who's fishing up there, you know, there probably aren't a lot of other jobs and a lot of other places you're going to be able to go. I mean, you have to color within the lines. You're going to end up somewhere else.
If you're a captain, most of those people have jobs. Either they're fishermen all year round down here, or they're teachers or lawyers. You know, these guys have all other jobs. It's very hard to be a fisherman full time. Some of them are, like Sharon. But either way, you cannot miss out on a big day up there. Or you're not going to make money that year.
You've told him this happened several times in the book, where it is, and this is one of the reasons why I think the pebble mine issue is such a huge deal, because you talked about just throwing the net in. What was you mentioned this morning, the idea that if you and I were there and we just threw the net in, and you just, you know, and you just let it sit for a few minutes, and you come back and there's, you know, there's thousands and thousands of pounds of fish in there. That, I mean, there's that really you almost don't have to. I say you don't have to work, but you don't have to seek the fish out. It's not like you're having to find them. And that's, you know, why everybody's sort of there, and that's why it's such an exceptional place. It is this strange confluence of natural occurrences where, you know, all you have to do is just stick the net in, and it's like the fish are just throwing themselves onto the boat, basically.
Yeah, the work is getting the fish in. That's the physical work. But in terms of, like, finding the fish, when the fish are running in Bristol Bay, remember, this is a 40 million strong run. When they're running, it is a kind of a combination of a great deal of excitement, like something that's very deep inside of you, combined with an absolute, a huge sense of fear. Because when they're running that strong and you're in the game, this is where people drown. Because what happens is you have your nets out and the fish hit that hard. And you have two nets out, maybe three nets out. Well, if they're all hitting, you can only take so many pounds on your boat.
Right.
And you only have so much strength in your arms and the person, two other people with you. And also you have a clock that's ticking. There's always a clock ticking. It's a fishing game. You have to be out of that water by midnight. You have to be out of that water by 2 a.m. And if your net's in the water, they will find you. So there's a game going on. It takes hours to get that kind of fish in.
And so the fish and the nets are actually so heavy. And
so heavy.
That they're pulling you, and yet it's the weight that makes it impossible to get it onto the boat so that they're not sinking you anymore.
Exactly. Well, people do it. On in my book, I talk about June 26th in 2005. It was the biggest day in Icky Gick. It was the biggest. We were there. It was maybe 10 days prior to what would be a normal peak, and we got all caught off guard. We didn't know what was happening. It was a slow, calm day, and all of a sudden everybody's corks were gone. The corks are what keeps the net on the water. If you looked out, they were all gone. If they're all gone, what does that tell you? They're all sunk. It takes a lot of weight to sink corks. And all the corks were sunk, and people were just cutting their nets with machetes because it was so heavy and their boats were sinking and they couldn't do it. And they just let the nets go out into the sea with you know, maybe $15,000 worth of salmon on board. Mm. You know.
We should take a moment here to mention that you're going to be doing a couple things. This Friday, you're going to be hosting a fundraiser. It's Friday. That is this Friday, February 25th, from 6 to 10 p.m., and this is going to be in Astoria at Clemente's. And this is a thing to it's a benefit for Trout Unlimited. And Trout Unlimited is one of the organizations that's helping to fight the creation of the Pebble Mine, about which we'll talk in a second. So that's going to be happening Friday, Clemente's Restaurant, from 6 to 10 p.m. That's Friday, February 25th. You're going to be reading, and there's going to be a lot of things happening there. And then Saturday, there's two things happening back to back. You're going to be screening a short film based on Red Summer. That is at 3 p.m., the Columbia Theater. And then at 6 p.m., you're going to be at the Astoria Event Center reading from the book. A lot of people, especially in Portland, they've seen the stickers and flyers everywhere. We're at the place where I get my haircut, that they're all over the mirrors. You sit there and you look at it for 25 minutes while you're getting your sideburns trimmed or something. And people are in opposition to it. For those who don't know, walk us through, first of all, what the Pebble Mine would be if it were created.
If Pebble Mine was created, it would be the largest gold copper mine in the United States, one of the biggest in the world, probably one of the top three. Molybdenum, which is a steel. It goes with steel. It will create the largest dams on Earth, which will be tailings dams to hold back the waste. It will probably create, in money, maybe $300 to $400 billion.
And when you say waste, this isn't just like they're digging up the dirt and sticking it over in the neighbor's yard. Like this, waste means something a little more insidious.
Well, waste isn't. It's a little bit of both. It's not quite what you think. It's not like some evil thing. A lot of it's just literally dirt and rock. The problem is that the earth contains a lot of things that are in the earth, but once they're exposed to air or water, become something else. And one of those things is pyrite, which is very, very common in earth. But once you upturn it and you give it to air or water, it starts to disintegrate immediately. And that becomes sulfuric acid, and that becomes poison to water. And there's no way that we know as human beings to stop that process. The only way to stop it is to stick it all in back into water, so it's hidden, or back under the earth. And it's very difficult to do those things, especially when you're talking, in this case, 10 billion tons of waste, which will be just beyond almost scale of thinking.
And especially it's got to be held back like forever.
Yeah, the promise of the mine. Okay, this is the problem with mine companies. I know mine. I took the tour of the mine. I took the tour of the mine with the CEO of the mine. The problem with how the miners think is a little bit like BP in the Gulf. Everything is acceptable risk if the money works. If they have to pay out $20 billion in the Gulf to fix everybody's problems, that's not a problem as long as they can make another $20 billion over 10 years.
It's the cost of doing business.
Yeah. So the mining company has got an 80-year plan, for instance. Then they'll shut down. Then they'll leave 3 tailings dams bigger than anything on the planet that have to live there for eternity.
Right.
Well, I don't really know of any earthen dam that we know of that's even lasted 200 years.
So all of that stuff eventually will just find its way into the water table, into the salmon run.
The problem is, and this is the problem you have to really get on board with in terms of Pebble Mine. Illilama Lake is the largest lake in Alaska. It's very remote, and it's the largest hatchery of sockeye salmon on the earth. It feeds the Bristol Bay's fishery. This mine would be 14 miles as a crow flies, sitting on top of 2 salmon-feeding rivers. If it's built up there, you'll never see it. No one will ever see this mine. It'll be so far removed. But eventually, you're going to have water runoff. You're going to have toxic runoff go into that lake. It's already been proven that small amounts of copper, not even to mention sulfuric acid, small amounts of copper have a very, very noticeable effect on salmon fry. They make them – they don't kill them. It's interesting. What they do is it just a really small particle per billions – makes salmon fry stop moving very much. If you watch a little guy in a tank, he's like darting around. That's what they do, right? As soon as copper is introduced, which will be bleeding off that mountain a lot, of course, for 75 years, they kind of slow down. And now if you're a fish, you just have to think about this a little bit. The only reason those fry survive is because they have to get away from predators. So the idea is that if you introduce copper,
it just becomes a ripple effect.
They'll just all be eaten.
And we should note at this point, we were talking about this a bit this morning, that, and it's like you're not like some anti-mining activist. You're not not some anti-progress hippie. And as you pointed out, if we were to be opposed to mining in general, I mean, that would just sort of make all of us massive hypocrites because our homes are filled with copper, our electronic devices, all the computers, everything, comes out of the ground at some point. It has to do with this particular mine at this particular place just kind of happens to be, and it's just amazing when you think about it because the mine is right by this place where, it's just a sheer numbers game where the confluence of the way that all of these, rivers and the salmon runs come together, it's just, the rivers are full of money. As you noted, the salmon are just like leaping onto the boat.
Right.
And you couldn't create that if you tried. No. If you just tried to create a place that had so much, that had so much financial potential in terms of like the salmon, you wouldn't be able to do it. And so you have this here, and it is like the worst possible luck of the draw that is where they're wanting to, to stick the pebble mine.
And it's not just from what I read, it's not just, that. It's also the effect of roads and bridges on the area, because it's one of the roads to get to the mine would end up crossing something like 20 different.
88. 88 salmon feeding creeks.
Yeah.
One that have 3 pipes that carry the slurry and the diesel and whatever else. If any of them break, problems. Salmon are extremely, extremely sensitive to change in temperature or chemicals in water. They usually leave. So you have the 88-mile road, you have a deep sea port, and here's the big one. There are 2 big ones. You have an electrical grid that will be larger than the city of Alaska. to run the mine. Well, we're going to get that, one. Two, you will use more water per year in that mine than you use all in Alaska. I mean, all in Anchorage. So, and to you know, I don't know if you, when you make an open pit mine, remember, this is tundra. This, everything out there is a sponge of water. So if you make a mile, 2 mile wide open pit, mile this, a mile deep, or, you know, 800, 900 feet, you have to basically drain, it's like a reversed, you have to drain every single ounce of water that is that deep around it. So otherwise, it's going to flood the mine.
Right.
So you're pumping every single ounce of water from around it for miles so that no water goes into the mine. And that goes on for 75 years. So those rivers will disappear. They've already admitted that. Those rivers will disappear.
And the dams they're talking about building are like Hoover-sized dams, too.
Bigger
like,
than that.
Like yeah. 4 miles long by, like what, something
700 feet
high.
Yeah, they're massive earthen dams. And one of the big earthen dams in the world that does hold back copper, you know, mine toxic waste, it was in Spain, and it blew. It blew open not long ago. And and China also, it happened, and went into a river and killed all the fish.
You know, the idea that they have an 80-year contract there for something that, as you noted, has to be there forever. I mean, it has to be able to hold back the waste forever. And the company's contract is for 80 years, by which time everybody involved will have safely shuffled off their mortal coil.
Exactly. So. And that's the thing that we have to understand. It isn't – and again, I'm not anti – I live in a mining town. I live in a town that was built – it was one of the richest towns in the United States, Bisbee, Arizona. It was built on copper. They're going to probably reopen that mine. Now, if you were to sit here and put me and it's going to have a great effect on the town. I would say openly, I would rather you have open that mine in Bisbee, and I will move. I'll move. I'm willing to pick up my family, sell my house, and leave before you open that mine at Pebble. Because Bisbee's used to mining. You know what I mean? It's already been built in. I get it. I get how it will not kill it, but it will expand it, and I don't want to be around it. Pebble will... You're talking about a $400 million industry of salmon fishing, plus people's lives, native people. This is their whole culture. You have 30 villages around that would probably be destroyed. So the impact of that mine on both the economy, on fish, is so much more than like on my town where it would probably be a boom. To be honest with you, I just don't want to be around it. You know,
it just before we, I wanted to ask you a few more questions before we take our next break. But I just something that people always say is they well, you know, there's just so much money involved. They feel like if they come to the conclusion that they don't want it, there's still nothing they can do about it. And it seems like most of the people in that area don't want it. But you know, the great momentum of industry is very often unimpedable. So, dumb question: is there anything people can do?
It's really tough. I've spent a lot of time, like I said, up there, and Alaska's built for industry. You know, they passed a law 2 years ago that just seems, if you, on the face of it, absolutely insane. It allows you to put the waste of a mine into a lake, which in the case of Pebble Mine is literally death to the copper run, to the salmon run. Yeah, the reason there's so much energy from Trout Unlimited, from various groups, is because they have to stop it before it gets to the permitting process. Because the people in the permitting office in Alaska are all from the industry. It's a little bit like Bush when he had 100 people from the mining and timber industry running the EPA. It's just like, what are you, crazy?
Right.
So these people all are attached to that lobbying group. So once it gets into the permitting process, it's probably over. We're not there yet. And as a matter of fact... A big thing that happened about a month ago was the EPA and the Obama administration said they're going to review the Pebble Mine situation. And that's going to take a year. And then they're going to have public meetings, which they always have to have, you know, and everybody gives their side and blah, blah, blah. You're going to have Anglo-American and Northern Dynasty. Anglo-American is the English company that runs this thing, and Northern Dynasty is the junior company that found it. They're going to have their little moment in the sun, and then you're going to have thousands and thousands and thousands of people. Native people, all these people saying you cannot do this, and this is why. Now, if you're an official in the EPA and you're a scientist, and all you're hearing is Anglo-American saying we're going to dig up a lot of stuff and make a lot of money, versus an entire culture of people, and you say yes, then it's insane. you know, then I don't know how to make sense of anything.
We should note again that you're going to be tomorrow, or I'm sorry, Friday, February 25th, 6 to 10 p.m. In Astoria at Clemente's Restaurant, so to benefit and fundraiser for Trout Unlimited. And then Saturday, you're going to be screening the demo film Red Summer, which is a short film based on the book that's going to be at the Columbia Theater at 3 p.m. And at 6 p.m., you're going to be reading from Red Summer at the Astoria Event Center. And I can't recommend the book The High Island. If it really is fantastic. I probably asked you this last time we talked about Fools Rush In, which is, you know, you're there in the war in Sarajevo. I mean, do you just find everyday life just incredibly dull? I mean, do you just like wake up and you just, you know, it's like, I mean, you're in Sarajevo and then, you know, I'm not trying to make light of it. You're in Sarajevo and then you're, you know, in an Alaskan fishing boat. And it's like, what could possibly happen at your house that would just even enthuse you to get out of bed? You know, it could be a fire in the living room and you'd be like, seen it, you know?
No, I'll tell you what happens in my house every single day at 5:30 is one of my two daughters gets up and is one of them's got poop and one wants to get up and make pancakes. So, I mean, you know, there's always something going on.
The secret to excitement
house.
Is poop and pancakes.
And I would imagine the upside of that would be that it probably is very hard for you to get like really worked up about dumb crap.
About dumb crap, I don't get worked up. However, it's funny. I mean, a lot of it comes from the war. You know, there's a certain perspective that gets built into you after time. But it's funny. In my town, people know my history, and there's a little bit of a thing about it. But I live in a very quiet town, very, very calm, very small. And that's on purpose, because my other life is a little bit insane. And my home life is very, very sedate. I mean, we have a very lively life, you know what I mean? Friends and stuff, but it's not a city and it's not...
Well, you're not being shot at.
No, but I do live on the border, so there's, you know...
Would you ever, I mean, having had the Fool's Rush In experience, having been in Sarajevo and then, you know, doing these 4 years on this fishing boat, would you ever put yourself in a situation like that now
Fishing, I would. Fishing, I would. Yeah, I can fish. But if the war...
The family, I mean, does having a family, does that probably put up an intractable barrier to you to going into a situation like that in the future?
In certain things. But like, I've been asked to go to war recently, and I'm not going to go to war unless it's, I believe in it, you know, in a big, big way. Meaning what I'm going to get out of it, what I'm going to tell, what I'm going to show. If it's just kind of common reporting, I'm not going to do it right now. Fishing I'll do, because I believe in myself and I believe in Sharon. I believe in we'll figure out how to survive even bad times. I mean, there was times where, you know, we thought we were – something was going to happen very bad. One or two of us were going to drown. We got lucky, but it all happened within seconds, and it was solved in seconds. It was – it's very it's hard to describe the fear and then the elation of solving the problem.
Does that get – if you're in – you know, if you're in Sarajevo and you feel like you're, you know, you talked about the sequence of going to get water and navigating this sort of, you're in this alley that effectively just becomes this shooting gallery. Do you get hooked on that though? Does it become a sort of, does it become not that you want to be in danger, but do you get hooked on the elation of surviving it, of not getting killed?
You know, I never had that sensation. I mean, yes, I was always glad I didn't get killed that day, but I never had a... Whenever I did something, it was for a reason, like get water, find that person, you know, whatever. There was always a goal. And, you know, I was always happy if the person in the water was in a safer spot. It wasn't, you know what I mean? In a place like Sarajevo during that time, there was enough. You could be sitting in a room drinking a cup of coffee for 30 days straight and be killed and never leave that room because you got unlucky and the shell came through your window. So you didn't have to go look very much to feel in trouble. You know what I mean? So I didn't do those things for that reason. I'm not hooked on that, or I'd be doing a lot more of it today. I'm just, like, you know, we talked about it maybe a little earlier, is that I'm extremely drawn toward places where life circumstances or the environment or whatever it is creating a stripping agent where, you know, you and I now are who we are. And you might be an a-hole. But
no, I don't want to put that to a vote or anything.
You might be an absolute a-hole, but if you're the guy that can watch our back or do this certain thing or what, or have a sense of humor, maybe, you know what I mean? Maybe in your case, and lighten it all up, then you're in. Okay, yeah, you're an a-hole, but you're in. So
it's really the story of my life, Bill. That really is a...
By the way, before you segue away from this, people who are interested in knowing more about Red Summer, there's... offshoot of your website. You have a page, redsummer.info, and you're also like really
terrific photographer, and there's some gorgeous photographs.
I'm glad you said that. They're beautiful.
There's one in particular of Sharon Hart that's just a gorgeous, gorgeous photo.
Yeah. The town really does have just a, you know, really that whole area has just this sort of this beautiful wasteland. It's sort of this beautiful disaster.
It is beautiful. It is totally. It's weird because when you fly over it, it's totally flat. Remember, it's Ice Age flat. It got ripped apart, so it's just totally flat. But that's from above. When you get down, of course, is undulations and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But you asked me earlier why I kept going.
Right.
And I only answered really the human part of it, which is camaraderie and certain things. But the other part is that I've traveled the world many times, and I don't know a place where I can go and, you know, wake up, look out the window, there's a grizzly. Then there's a wolf's on the river, and then there's foxes, and then there's, you know, we're fishing, and there's 50 beluga coming up right next to us. And then upriver by the lake, there's a walrus underneath our boat. I mean, you know, I don't know any place in the world where you get to see, maybe the Serengeti or something, but you feel in there you've paid $10,000 to go in a caravan to go to a spot to watch cheetahs, you know what I mean? This is a place where, you know, as long as you can, I have an end being a fisherman, but if you can get up there, it's all right there, and there's no control. It's like the world's greatest Jurassic Park, you know.
The author Joe McGinnis took a lot of crap for moving in next door to Sarah Palin's family to work on a book about her. But I read an interview with him, and he said that the biggest selling point for him doing the book was that he had lived in Alaska years earlier, and he had always dreamed of going back. He had never gotten Alaska out of his head. Right. And when the opportunity came to write this book, it was really more about the fact that he was going to get paid to go move back to Alaska for a while.
And someone paid me to go to Alaska. I'd take my family in a heartbeat because it's very expensive, so you have to figure something out. But it's you know, it's a real magical place.
I got an email. Somebody has a question. They said they talked about it. It sounds like a place of extreme poverty, and yet if they're making it, basically it's a long bit, but it's successful. If they're making so much money, if there is so much money in fishing, how is it that it seems like a place where people are so destitute? Do they not? Is it just expensive to live there? Is it the equipment? Is it the insurance? Do people just not save? Do they drink it away?
Right. That's a good question. Actually, there's a couple things to that. People making the big money, the highliners, they call them, those people maybe make $150,000, $200,000, right? They don't live in Alaska. They live in Seattle and Portland, and they're hardcore fishermen who just, this is what they do when they get out of there. So he's talking about more native people. Native fishermen, this is a general blanket statement, but it's probably true. They don't fish as hard as the white guy. It's not a matter as they're not as good a fisherman. It's just, you know, that's not their style. They fish at a different pace and their whole lives are different paces. So they don't make quite as much money. The average median income in Ikigik is almost 50 grand. Now, that would not be poverty in most America. But in Alaska, in native Alaska, they're poor. Because to fly to Alaska, let's say they want to go from Ikigik to Anchorage for a family of four. That's over $3,000 in flights. If you want to get, if you live in Ikigik and you want a can of peanut butter, it's going to cost you $9 or $10. If you want to fly in a shipment from Fry's or whatever it is, what you need, that might be a $2,000 shipment. So, you know what I mean? Once you add all that up and the heating bill, you know, it's below 20 below zero for 6 or 8 weeks. The ice, you know, it's frozen. So you add all that up, that's $50,000 gone.
We mentioned early on that Alaska is the highest incidence of alcoholism in the country. It sounds like a dumb question, but is it just because you got like endless weeks or months with nothing to do? Is it because of the composition of the people? You know, the mix of people from, you know. Is it the job itself that just attracts people who are hard drinkers?
Well, I mean, fishing itself is a very hard. It's one of the hardest professions, and you know, we know of as in men and in mankind. So you know, it almost all fishermen have a form of medication because the pain is too much. And maybe they're doing yoga on the side. I don't know, but most of them, you know, there's a lot of pain pills, or there's alcohol, or there's little smoke. Something is going on where you chill your vibe because it's too hard to work. But sometimes you're too tired and you can't do those things. And a lot of guys don't do any of that when they go home. It's just there they do it because it's kind of part of this cycle that you have to get through the day. I don't think it's, you know, the people aren't bad or anything. It just kind of comes with that. It's a hard, hard profession. And it's like one of those things where if you do hard labor, there's a part of us that, like, you know, you sit down and you have a beer afterwards because you feel like you earned it. You know, it's that kind of thing.
Do a lot of people there who are lifers, or this is their primary, you know, this is what they do with their life, do they wish they were doing something else? Do they wish they could, that
no.
they were in a different place in their
no,
life?
No one I know thinks that. These people, when you start fishing, it is something that, it has to do with that freedom, that sense of freedom. And it is, yes, there's no law. That's not really the biggest part of the freedom. The freedom is, if I got my act together, okay, let's go even further. Let's go extreme. I don't have a high school diploma. A lot of these guys are lawyers and, you know, whatever. But let's just say, let's pretend. So I have no prospects. And somehow I got a boat after 5 years. I saved up enough to buy a boat. And I got a permit. Well, you know, I can make $100,000 in 6 weeks. Maybe I pocket 60 of it. And no one tells me what to do. I mean, yes, there's fish and game and everything. But as long as I follow the rules, there's no one coming around me to tell me what to do. I know what I'm doing. I know how to fix my engine. I know how to put gas in. I know how to go out there. I know where the fish are. And that's a real accomplishment, to feel like, you know, you are the owner of your own, let's say, destiny each day. You know what I mean? Like, you are going to make it. When you go into an office, ultimately you're working for somebody. You know what I mean? There's nothing there. Maybe it's paper. Maybe it's, you know, airways. But there's nothing there. When you're done fishing for the day, there's 10,000 pounds in the back of your boat that you're going to, you know what I mean?
It's a tangible result.
It's a tangible result. And also the fishing industry it pays you before you leave. You're not waiting for a check in fishing. In the old days, in the 80s and 70s, they paid you in cash.
Well, and if you want to make it more, you know, you can catch more.
It's based
on exactly what you bring in.
Right.
So you can see the result. You know, a lot of places, doesn't matter whether you work your ass off or whether you just do the bare minimum, you're going to get the same paycheck at the end of the week. Fishing, you know, it's directly tied to what goes on the net.
The good news, and also I want to stress this a lot, especially because of the Northwest. The protection of that run is so extremely, you know, in place and well done that they're not overfishing it. You know what I mean? So if you buy wild salmon from Alaska, there's not a threat of like, oh, we're going to – this is the big misnomer. I don't want to eat wild salmon because I don't want to take anything more from the fishery.
Right.
The only thing that's going to happen if more people eat wild salmon is the price for the fishermen is going to go up, and that's it, because they will not – fishing game will not – they'll shut a whole season down. They've done it. I've been up there for 12 days straight with no fishing because they don't have enough going up the rivers. They control it, not the fishermen. You know what I mean? Like, they don't let us fish unless they have a certain amount of numbers going back up to the lakes to spawn. So it's very controlled, you know.
I think a lot of people just don't, and I'm myself among them, but just don't. We're so far removed from where our food comes from, and I'm not, you know, which is fine. And I have no. It's not like I want to be out like stalking a moose in the morning or something. but I think one result of that is there are a lot of filters on how. There's a lot of filters in how you perceive the creation of your food and how
That's
the food
right.
is brought to you.
That's right.
And I think people just view it through a strange prism. It really is a fantastic book. It's Red Summer, The Danger and Madness of Commercial Salmon Fishing in Alaska. And Bill Carter, you're going to be at Bristol Bay Fundraiser Friday, February 25th, 6 to 10. And you're going to be at Clemente's Restaurant.
That'd be really fun, too, that one.
It is. I know we have listeners in Astoria. So really, if you're there, you're going to be near there. You really ought to go. And then Saturday, 3 p.m., the Columbia Theater in Astoria. Screening the short film based on Red Summer, and 6 p.m. reading some book. I will end this with one anecdote. I think I mentioned this to you this morning. My brother was in town over Christmas, and he was looking for something. He just finished his book. He was looking for something to read, and my wife Laura, she was just all over the Fool's Rush In thing, and she brought it. She said, "You really got to read this." And my brother said, "Well, okay, you know, I got a lot of people give me books," and I said, "No, really, you trust me, you really, really have to read that." And it wasn't like he was skeptical. It's just everybody had sort of given him something to read, and he's like, "Well, I'll figure it out later. I'll pick something." And so we sent him home with a whole bunch of books. And I know his in-laws did as well. And so I get this text message from him at like 2 a.m, about 7 days later. And it just says, it was just 5 words. It just says, "Fools rush in. F yeah." It's like 3 exclamation marks. So Fools Rush In and Red Summer, both fantastic. And the film is Miss Sarajevo, which I think you said that you two has actually started. Are they doing a thing right now? They play
it's
that
amazing.
At their shows?
They called me last week and they said –
They called me last week. Yeah. I was just around and Bono rang me up.
Well, they called in October asking if they could use the footage. Now, ironically, you know, Bono and I own the footage together, but he gave me all the power over it. So they called and said, "Hey, we want to show Miss Sarajevo behind us when we sing Miss Sarajevo on tour." I said, "Yeah, well, great." And there's certain licensing issues. And then So they didn't do it. And I was like, oh, bummer. And then they called last week and said, well, you know what? We're going to start in Johannesburg on February 13th. So I said, well, let's go. So it showed to 105,000 people, and it was pretty amazing. And so now it's going to be on – when he comes to America and they play in Seattle, you're going to see Miss Serieva on the big screen.
Your life is different than most people's lives, I think. Bill Carter, ladies and gentlemen, best of continued success in all things, my friend. It's always a pleasure. Bill Carter, again, you can find out more. We'll have all this information up and the links at rickemerson.com. We're back after this. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It is Wednesday, February 23rd, 2000. And 11. Don't go anywhere. We are back after this.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Here's to life.
Hello, Don Taylor.
Hiya.
How are you?
I'm good.
My life always seems so lame after talking to guys like that. It's like the Seth Aaron yesterday, you know. Yesterday I just didn't feel pretty. Today I just don't feel exciting.
Laura's right. He is dreamy.
He really is.
He is. Yeah. He looks a bit like Carl Hiaasen, who I've also had a crush on for a long, long time.
I never really thought about that, but that's really true. I thought of it the other day. I was listening to a podcast done by our good friend Lisa Desjardins. She dropped a Carl Hiaasen reference. She was interviewing some folks in Miami somewhere, and she was talking about, you know, or some sleepy little suburb in Florida, and she said it's the sort of place that Carl Hiaasen would probably write novels about. And I thought, Don Taylor. The Rick Emerson Radio Program made possible by y'all and your kind patronage. Also a series of fine business partners, including Squires Electric. Find out more about them by going to squireselectric.com, 503-252-1609. That is 503-252-1609. And you might want to contact Squires Electric for, I don't know, any number of things. Like, let's say you're a guy that just decided to jam 75 plugs all into one outlet via a power strip. Not that I've ever been that guy. Not that I would know anything about being that guy. Not that I would, by the way. And
maybe your fishing boat is on the fritz.
I was just going to say, he talks in here about, you know, the guys. Well, it's like that scene in Jaws where it's like they're having to, because that's the only reference point I have for anything. I actually asked him this morning, I said, do they all look like Robert Shaw? Just because I'm an idiot. But he talks about, you know, it's like you're out there in the middle of the night and salt water has come in and just destroyed everything. And also you've got 7 jillion pounds of fish threatening to sink. I mean, it basically is the end of Jaws. And then there's a guy down there with like a screwdriver in the dark trying to fix the engine or something. And it's like, I would just...
You'd curl up into a little ball and start weeping like a girl.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would just die just to sort of get to the end of this, you know, just to get to the bottom line, because that's clearly where that's going to end up for me. I think I just to avoid muss and fuss. Yeah. If you are electrically inept or you're just lazy, or perhaps you've got enough money that you've got people for that now, well, Squires Electric can be those people. Electrical installers, contractors, supervisors, and mavens. Find out more about them by calling 503-252-1609 or going to squireselectric.com. That is wires are wiring your home or your business. Maybe you're going to be expanding your business. Maybe you got a home office, or maybe you're going to be moving into a brand new place. You want to make sure that it all works. It's 503-252-1609 or squireselectric.com. That is squireselectric.com.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
A northern Indiana restaurant that erected billboards referring to the 1978 Jonestown cult massacre, in which more than 900 people died, has removed the signs following complaints that they were offensive. Jeff Leslie, Vice President of Sales and Marketing at Hacienda, which is a restaurant in Indiana, acknowledged that the billboards were a mistake. He said the South Bend-based company ordered the signs removed less than 2 weeks into their new advertising campaign. He said, "We want to be noticed, but our role is not to be controversial or edgy. We do have a responsibility to advertise with care." The billboards included the statement, "We're like a cult with better Kool-Aid," over a glass containing a mixed drink, as well as the phrase, "To die for."
That's awesome.
In November 1978, more than 900 members of Jim Jones' People's Temple drank cyanide-laced grape failure punch in a mass murder and suicide.
Yeah, life is for the living, Don. I really think you just have to embrace the now. Don't let go of all that outdated nonsense. Live in the present.
It's 1978. Surely it's not too soon.
Be here now. I got to tell you that this is actually... I tried to do this at CBS and they resisted for some reason. But some years ago, I owned a company with some friends of mine. And we made little name tags. We made little ID badges, not unlike the ones we have here, little, you know, like you've seen like a backstage laminate or something. But it was actually all of our names on packets of Kool-Aid that were then sealed and made into laminates. Because we fashioned ourselves edgy.
And they're the right size.
And it was the right size. That was the thing. And so then we tried to do it again. And I am proud to say that was my idea. And then we tried to do it again at CBS. We actually went so far. I forget who did this. It might have been a listener who actually got Kool-Aid packages and photoshopped them so it actually, instead of the flavor, it said like Scotty J, like instead of grape. And so I got them all made because of the whole, you know, like, he's an edgy Gen X motormouth with a loyal cult following.
Oh, yeah.
And then CBS, that lasted like a day. And then they told us we were not allowed to wear those anywhere station represented. No sense of humor anymore.
I tried to get some friends a number of years ago, about 15 years ago, I tried to get some friends interested in us, like, pooling our money together and maybe getting some money together to buy the Jonestown compound.
Is it for sale?
It was. It's actually been for sale a couple of times.
How is it that you can't sell that? It seems like just the tourism, like the museum revenue alone would justify
it. Yeah, I know. It's like, well, there's, I guess it's got something of a bad reputation.
It's not like...
The natives on the island believe it's haunted.
Well,
But on the other hand, though, it's relatively inexpensive. It's on a tropical island.
Yeah, I mean...
It's a compound... With, like, many, many buildings. Lots of people can live there. It's got its own airstrip. It's got beaches.
Needs a cleaning,
come
but yes.
On.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, you might want to hose down the walls.
Put some air wick.
You know.
But, you know, I mean, well, look, that's the thing.
And
where,
you can get it for a song.
It astounds me that nobody has... It astounds me that somebody hasn't bought it, because if one of the things that keeps it from being sellable is the fact that, you know, there's this huge... Yes, this cult suicide of 1,000 people. But, you know, there's a lot of people go like, well, there's bad vibes or whatever. The place. It seems like there's probably some guy who, A, has money, and B, you know, like is, you know, like believes in science and stuff and not the haunting. And would just buy it just to sell it to, like, you know, and then to lease it. I was going to say lease it out to a company, but see, maybe that is the problem. Maybe it's not that you can't buy it. It's that what are you going to do with it? And, unless you want to put up a country club, which would probably just be you and your friends. But it's not like you can just buy it and sell it to the Del Monte Corporation, because probably no company wants it to be known that their factory is at Jonestown.
See, and that's what I don't understand, because it's like, you know, you could put like a Club Med or something there. And are people – it's just weird to me that people would say, well, I'm not going to go there on my vacation because 40 years ago there was a massacre. It's like,
well you and I wouldn't say that, but probably the rabble would. That's the thing, is the vast unwashed
And it's not even like they were set upon by hooligans or angry villagers or something. They – You know, they killed themselves under the thrall, you know, of a charismatic leader.
Presumably it was what they wanted.
But, you know, I guess it's the whole taint of the whole thing. Anyway, this restaurant had these billboards, and a woman who lives in South Bend, who lives a few blocks away, said she was so shocked when she first saw the message. She drove around the block to take another look at it because she said, I thought perhaps I had misread the sign.
I wasn't offended enough the first time. I had to see it two or three more times before writing an angry missive to the local editor.
Yeah, so somebody who works in marketing at the University of Notre Dame said that they want people to think there are more things to love there than the food, but it's not the right humor for their clientele.
Seriously, people just have no – people are way too uptight.
Yeah.
By the way, somebody says, you know, the great thing about the Rick Emerson radio program is the Three's Company jokes and spider clown porn coexisting with your more NPR side.
Yeah,
so,
I think so.
You know, we like to have layers and textures and facets. We like to be a constantly unfolding basket of surprises and goodness here.
Speaking of clowns, I have a clown watch for
Excellent.
You.
And apparently – so now I feel like an ass. At some point, Kelly Clark was – that was Kelly Clark who was attempting to get on the show. So I'm going to see if we can schedule it for tomorrow. We may not be able to, but I – so it's just a whole thing where I
– Sorry, Kelly Clark.
It's all my fault.
We love you.
Just blame it on me. I'm sorry. What are we doing?
Clowns.
Clown watch. All right. Here's your clown watch. Here's your clown watch for Wednesday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Circus Supermarkets celebrated its 55th anniversary on January 18th with a public gathering at the company's trademark clown located on Route 35 in Middletown. That would be Middletown, Ohio. Food Circus's name was born with the grand opening of a new store in Middletown in 1956. With the advent of the company name, the circus theme was instituted with the iconic so-called evil clown of Middletown in the company's flagship Food Circus Supermarket. Yes, there. Their mascot at Food Circus is known by all the locals as the Evil Clown. And I have uploaded a photograph of the Food Circus clown. Yes, he is an angry, sinister, suspicious-looking clown.
Maybe he's an evil clown, so maybe it was not really necessary to ask that.
Well, any giant clown is going to be off-putting.
But when
the clown looks, he looks shifty. He looks shifty, and he's holding one red finger up, like he's
scolding you in some way?
I think he's saying something like, our grocery store is number one or something, but really he has this white-gloved hand with something red on the tip of his finger. Something red. Yeah, exactly. The Food Town store was closed in 1991 and converted to a spirits liquor store. The president and the owner, who was an assemblyman in town, was approached by residents who were concerned about what would become of what had turned into a Middletown, Ohio landmark.
Yes, I can imagine they might be.
Because he's 22 feet tall. That's a picture of a painting in one of the windows, by the way. The actual clown sign out on the street is 22 feet tall.
I am going there right now.
Feel free to Google Food Circus Evil Clown if you want more pictures.
Food Circus Evil Clown.
So at the townsfolk's insistence, the decision was made to keep the clown sign. It has become the most recognizable symbol in the township of Middletown, as well as part of the Food Circus heritage.
That's fantastic.
Food Circus, by the way, is one of New Jersey's top 100 employers, according to the New Jersey Chamber of Commerce. So I guess Middletown's in New Jersey. I thought it was Ohio. Okay, New Jersey. They have 10 locations and more than 1,300 employees in Monmouth, Middlesex, and Ocean counties. But yes, Middletown, New Jersey, home of the Food Circus Evil Clown.
I'm attempting to find it, and it's just... It ain't showing up for some reason.
I will reset, or I'll drop it in the.
Yeah, just if you want to stick it in the Dropbox, and I'll make sure that I get a post. That's probably my fault, by the way. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program, and that is your Clown Watch for what is today? Today is Wednesday. There's your Clown Watch for Wednesday on the. There we go. Thank you. If you want to stick that in the Dropbox, I'll. Because people are already demanding, where is clown photo? I demand clown photo.
Okay.
All right.
For the damn food clown.
Don't forget that coming up at 4 p.m. this afternoon, that is about 35 minutes from now, 4 p.m. Pacific time at Cascadia.fm, Don Taylor's going to be hosting Hamfist Radio along with Bobby Fatboy Roberts talking about the Academy Award, which, by the way, the Academy Awards ceremony, which we talked about during Legion of News, I had no idea it was going to be on this weekend. So it's a thing that just totally crept up on us. So you'll be talking about that. So there's the King's Speech, and then there's Social Network. So those are nominated for a bunch of things. Is it just? I mean, what else? Is there any other? Are those the two pillars of the nominations?
Yeah, those are pretty much the big ones. I know that. I know Natalie Portman is quite possibly going to win for Black Swan, and I that would be nice. She was very, very good in Black Swan.
I still haven't seen that.
You haven't really missed a lot if you miss it. If you've seen other Aronofsky movies, this is just a variation on his usual themes. But Natalie Portman is really, really good in it. I'm not sure. I mean, you know, Toy Story 3 is probably a shoe-in for Best Animated Feature.
Now are animated films... not eligible for Best Picture?
They gave them their own separate category a few years ago. So, yeah, so animated features are
I mean, they have their own
now.
Separate thing, but
I think
could they still win? Like, could the Academy just go like, no, we're nominating Toy Story 3?
I think they could. I think they could slip in there, but I think they'd just prefer to win over on their own side or something. I don't know.
That's one of those things where that's always been a little bit of a sticking point with me. I've always had a little bit of a grudge on behalf of animated filmmakers that they are not – that they are kind of stuck off into this ghetto of their own award, that they're not able to compete with – you know, unless there's just a sense that, like with Pixar, for example, that every time they released a film, it would just be, you know, there would just be no beating them. You know, so who's to say?
Yeah, I usually look forward to the Oscars anymore just, you know, to make fun of what people are wearing. And the last 2 years, Jon Stewart was the host. And the last couple of years with Jon Stewart were very entertaining. And for some reason this year, they decided that the host should be Anne Hathaway and James Franco, which doesn't really make any sense at all.
No, and I don't really know anybody who would be excited by that news.
But, yeah.
Oh, God. I just saw the evil clown photo.
Yes, there you go. The evil clown.
Okay, so the evil clown photo is now posted. It's up. Yeah. You go to rickemerson.com/pictures, visual aids for February 23rd.
And that's a painting of the evil clown from the grocery store's window. The actual sign of which we were speaking is that clown only 22 feet high.
Yeah, and by the way, it's not like he's known as the evil clown or they've decided to call him the evil clown. I think he is demonstrably evil.
He looks evil.
And also that you're right, he's holding up one finger and waggling at you in sort of a scolding, killing motion. And then, yes, he's taking apparently time out from daubing lettering on the wall in the blood of his victims because he's just got the one finger that's red there at the tip.
Yeah.
Jesus, God almighty. All right. No. I don't want to look at that. That's the thing that I looked at just long enough to get it posted. I don't want to know any more about that. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. See, now I'm all sullen and besmirched. Apparently, Kelly Clark was going to talk David Wu as well.
Oh.
So,
well,
I'm a big fail.
Will she talk to us tomorrow?
No. We're being shunned. It's my own fault, Don. I will take the blame for all of that. I'm going to go home and give myself a good scourging. Let's do one more, and then we'll do the Name That Snack clue for today. That is Wednesday. We will do Greatest Songs Ever Made tomorrow, along with another randomly selected batch of stories, which will alternately amuse and horrify you.
Well, we will segue into this with a story that is about snacks. A man in Forest Grove here in Oregon is accused of breaking into the Forest Grove School District's offices and a nearby church, but he stole just enough for a snack. Forest Grove officers say Christopher Robison, 26, set off an alarm when he broke into the school administration building early Sunday afternoon. There was just enough time for him to grab a handful of Dum Dum candies before his escape. Police arrived and found Robison walking nearby. When they confronted him, police say he confessed not only to the school district burglary, but also breaking into St. Bede Church on Elm Street earlier in the day, where he stole a liter of Sprite.
Here's the thing about, okay, Dum Dum candies are a thing that exist only to remind poor kids that they're poor. That's the only reason, and or at places where they're going to be giving away a lot of candy, but where they're going to do it for the lowest cost possible.
Now, the great thing about Dum Dums,
There's nothing good about Dum Dums.
No, they come in many, many flavors.
I knew you were going to say the variety of flavors.
I love that there is a variety of flavors. On the other hand, though,
They're crap, though.
They're too small, and they don't taste very good.
That's what I was going to say. So, like, you know, just because you're getting something like a, just because it tastes like pizza, Pina colada doesn't mean it's not terrible. It is. And here's the other thing about Dum Dum candies. That is a total tell when you go to school where everybody knows that you're just some dirt heel poor kid. Like, you can't, like, that's the thing. Would you like to swap lunch? I've got a bunch of Dum Dum lollipops here. Because that's a thing where immediately you give off the stench of poverty and people avoid you.
I always think it's strange to see them in any other context than Halloween candy assortments, much like the small things of Smarties.
Yeah.
It's like they just are native to that. It's like, you know.
Well, it's like seeing Jujubes, like, not at the movies.
Well, it's like how the circus, the mother's collection of cookies, the Frosted Circus animals, sort of the breakout star of that collection, where they got their own bag. But, like, nobody buys a bag of just, like, those horrible cardboard chocolate chip things that are in the mother's combination pack, because they're horrible.
I don't even know what the chocolate chip cardboard things are.
Oh, yeah. If you buy, there's the mother's cookies that you can get a bag of, like, the mother's cookie collection or cookie extravaganza or something. And it's little chocolate sandwich cookies, which aren't very good, but they're not really terrible. But they're those ones that aren't Oreos,
right,
that you get that they're chocolate with some kind of cream in the middle. And, and then ostensibly chocolate chip cookies, but they're just very small and hard, and they have these tiny little flecks of
something dark in them. It's like you're eating Cookie Crisp cereal, basically, as a cookie.
Yeah.
No, I'm with you on that. And that's the thing you don't ever want separately.
And then there's these plain white ones that are no good to anyone.
Yeah.
And then the circus animals. And everybody always just picks out
the circus animals. Yeah, though, I'm totally, okay, no, we're on the same page. I didn't know what you're talking about, and then it all came into focus.
Yeah.
Also, tomorrow, let me just do a couple things. So, tomorrow we'll do Greatest Songs Ever Made. We will also talk about Justified. Now, did you ever watch last week?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so Justified's new episode, that is Season 2, Episode 3, airs tonight. Then it's tonight. So maybe we'll do like a whole back-to-back TV thing. Maybe we'll do that and the Breaking Bad thing, sort of back-to-back, so we can sort of get two birds, one stone, etc. We'll do that. And then Friday, Mr. Big Jim Willig is going to be in the studio for another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. So that is what tomorrow and Friday hold for this, the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's time for clue number 3 for the EH Vending Name That Snack Contest. And don't forget, you got to wait until Friday until the final clue is given. But once it is, once clue number 5 comes your way on Friday, if you are the first person to correctly identify this week's snack via snack@rickemerson.com, that is snack@rickemerson.com, you win yourself a large bag of consumable goodness from EH Vending. EH Vending can be contacted in several ways, by the way. That is ehvending.com, website-wise. And if you can phone them in Vancouver, 360-816-1853. Or you can call 503-897-8255. 04. If you're not happy with your current vendor, if you don't ever really see them, if they're raising the rates, if you're starting a new business, or you're just starting from scratch with an office or a store, and you're looking to find somebody to provide vending service for you and your employees, so that they can work hard, long hours with a smile on their visage, not caring as they shun their families and friends in the service of your financial success. Really, the key to getting Americans to do that is to offer them a variety of fatty, sugary foods. Really with maybe like a sort of a smiling animal mascot in the front. You can find out how to do that by contacting EH Vending at ehvending.com, or again in Portland, 503-897-8255. 04. Everything from traditional candy and soda machines to coffee services and those large glass-fronted refrigerators. They got you covered on the vending front. Whatever your needs might be, please tell me you heard it here, if you will. Clue number three for this week is this week's third clue. Clue the third is crunchy. There you go. Crunchy. Clue number three. Once Friday comes and the fifth clue is given out, if you're the first person to correctly identify the snack at snack@rickemerson.com, you, yes, you, will win a large bag of things plus the esteem and respect and admiration of all who see you and surround you on a daily basis. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We can be live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milkpacking District in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Ackler, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa. We want to thank our guests, including Mr. Bill Carter. And we will return tomorrow with a recap of tonight's episode of Justified, also another installment of the greatest songs ever made. After a brief interlude, we'll have an encore of today's Legion of News, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. The Rick Emerson Show is made possible by a generous grant from y'all, so thank you, and continue to spread the word, if you will. It is Wednesday, February 23rd, 2011, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, as always, thank you for listening. Be safe. See y'all tomorrow. Bye now.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
When the fearless be your ushers and the shadows be your guide, the best way out of hell is through the other side. With a rattle and a gun, I find it I'm back at my favorite part. Will a midnight be your kind if your kind is faint of heart? When the world is sick and tired and it begs you to fall apart. Forever now, we're state of the art. We may be hanging by forever now, we're
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.